We're going to start with the two Senate bills that we have because there's some other amendments that we're waiting for on the school bills. So I will open a work session on Senate Bill 559. Do we have amendments, Elizabeth, for 559?
Chairman Stelbeck and members of the committee, what you have before you is a -A3 amendment for Senate Bill 559. And what this is just so you're understanding, with Senate Bill 559, is to reach the contents of this original bill, and it's adding in language to exempt all licenses granted by the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC licenses, from personal property taxation for centrally assessed telecommunications companies. This applies to tax years beginning July 1st of 1999. So this is a portion of the intangibles bill that we discussed earlier in session, the 2050. And what this is just FCC licenses are being an intangible, and this will be removed from the utilities' real market value, and in this case, it's mainly the wireless companies. This will have a loss of property taxes of approximately $420,000 in the first year, since it's beginning a year before House Bill 2050 did. It's beginning July 1st, 1999, so you've got 4 years. So a total loss of about $2.3 million over the 4 years. This will come primarily in the larger metropolitan counties like Multnomah, Washington, and Clackamas, because they do have the largest amount of utility value there, the wireless utility value. They have about 60% of all the wireless utility value in just those three counties. And for schools, it's about a little less than $1 million for the two biennium, so about a little $500,000 a biennium.
Okay. Thank you. Even though I did say work session, we do have some people who signed up to speak, so I'll ask Gary Conklin, Vishal, and Brian DeLashmet.
For one.
I'll begin if you prefer. Or...
All right. Who wishes to go first?
I'll go first.
Go ahead.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Gary Conkling, and I'm here today representing PCS, United States Cellular and VoiceStream Wireless, and joining me are Bruce Shaw from Sprint and Brian DeLashmet representing Nextel. First off, we want to thank the chair and the committee for your work on the intangible taxation issue this session. If you recall, you saw us here actively working on and in support of House Bill 2050. Which we believe is a good bill and a good response to the circumstance. It is our understanding that that bill will not make all three legs of the journey required to go into law this session. And so we come back, as we discussed with you earlier, to address portion of that issue that has a life of its own and a set of facts that stand on its own. That is the taxation of licenses issued by the Federal Communications Commission. As you're aware, some of these licenses that exist today are not taxed in the state of Oregon. For example, licenses that are held by radio and television broadcasters are not subject to property tax in Oregon. However, FCC licenses that are held by wireless companies are, in fact, subject to tax. They are also subject to litigation. In fact, the values that are on the roll today in the state of Oregon for wireless companies are the result of a settlement that expires next year. So if the legislature doesn't act, the Department of Revenue is left somewhat in a quandary of what to do. And in all likelihood, multiple parties could file suit. Those parties could range from local governments, which might assert that the full value of licenses should be added to the roll. It could be from a cellular company that obtained its license without cost in an allocated fashion for some imputed value that they would dispute. Or it could come from one of the original litigants, such as VoiceStream, alleging that the values are inappropriate. So to clarify the situation and to avoid what is an awkward situation, as well as to kind of complete a political loop, pledges were made by political leadership in this state that indicated that the FCC license issue would be dealt with completely as a condition for at least one company coming to Oregon and locating a call center that provided jobs in a non-Portland metropolitan community. Since that time, another call center that would have come to this state and located jobs in a non-metropolitan center was not located here because this issue remains in limbo. So we're here today to say regretfully that only a portion of perhaps the intangible issue can be resolved, but that in fact it should be resolved. It's in the best interest of not only the immediate parties. We think that in fact it can eliminate costly and disruptive litigation, and in fact is a beginning towards a larger solution of the issue, whatever that might be, that doesn't impede the ability of a larger solution to be even harder to solve at some future time. So we would ask you to support the Dash 83 amendments to Senate Bill 559. Mr. Chairman, on behalf of my clients, we particularly appreciate your willingness to entertain this issue at the line of the session and let my colleagues add a word or two.
Mr. Chair, Bruce Shull with Sprint. I think Gary has very eloquently expressed our desires on this matter, and I'll just okay, I second the motion on this bill.
Thank you. Ryan DeLessen with Nextel. I'll do the same thing. It's Saturday, and we're all tired, and Gary's done a good job.
Okay, any questions? Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Rasmussen.
I move the Dash A3 amendment.
Well, we have actually one of some of the people here from Jerry Scott and Sharon Scott.
I'm Sharon Scott from Salem.
Morning.
My concern is when we're giving more tax breaks to large corporations, that we are then going to be burdening the average citizen with more services that they're going to have to be taxed for. And I would like you to consider that when you're weighing these exemptions. Because we are doing this on the national level, we are doing this on state level, and it is putting people, average people, into poverty every time they have to increase their taxes or they lose a service that is then privatized, that they then have to pay for that service. So we are widening an income gap that is devastating people in our community, in our state. So I'd like you to seriously look at this and not just say, oh, this is a nice gift and we can afford this. Well, there's a lot of us folks who can't afford this bill.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Jerry Scott. I came down here this morning to talk about Senate Bill 559A as it was. Much to my shock, you guys have vetted it, which I'm very happy about. But it leaves me wondering, did anybody who might be on the opposite side of this issue than the other three gentlemen know about the hearing on the new Senate Bill 559, and if not, is this really a fair public hearing? Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Mr. Witt?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do either of you know how other states in the Western United States, if they tax or do not tax FCC licenses?
No, I don't.
No, I'm not familiar with the details of this. What I am really concerned about is what is happening, as I said, on the national level and actually on the international level, because as businesses continue to monopolize, we are losing even our Supreme Court and other courts' rulings over major businesses. And so I'm worried about kind of a central government ending up in the hands of the corporations.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I wonder if we can get some, if anybody on staff or any of the previous witnesses have any information as to how other states handle taxation of these licenses, particularly other states in the Western United States.
Representative Witt, I think you had testimony that a large number of the Western states have exempted intangibles, and this is one of the intangibles. So like Idaho has, Washington has, California has.
Yeah, thank you.
Could I say something else about that?
Sure.
That there is this movement nationally to continue to do this, and it doesn't mean that you have to fall in line just because everybody else seems to be doing it. It's like we tell our kids all the time, just because somebody else jumps off the bridge, you don't do it.
We appreciate your concern. We did spend many, many days on House Bill 2050 earlier in the session grappling with this issue. This is the ultralight version of that particular bill, and it's something that I think the preponderance of the testimony made sense to us about this particular kind of taxation of centrally assessed utilities and intangible assets. It's a very arcane little portion of the tax code, but I understand what you're saying about the general policy of shifting taxes.
Thank you.
We are at work session. Representative Rasmussen.
I move the dash A3 amendments to Senate Bill 559.
Representative Rasmussen moves the dash A3 amendments to Senate Bill 559. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Representative Merkley?
Sure, I do have a question, which is related to, should we pass this bill, the revenue that is lost to the local districts, is it obliged under other legislation to compensate those districts?
I didn't hear the end of your question.
If we change it and the local districts lose revenue, is the state obliged to compensate the local districts in any way?
Not under current law, under 2139, which we passed earlier, future decisions like this would have a share.
It just kicks in for decisions starting the next planning. Thank you.
Any objection to the A3 amendments? Mayor Doctor?
Mr. Chair?
Senator Rasmussen?
I move Senate Bill 559 to the floor as amended with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Rasmussen moves Senate Bill 559 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Senator Rasmussen?
I've never been a great fan of tax breaks for the sake of tax breaks. And those who have spent any time with me know that I come to this one struggling and kicking and screaming, but this particular piece is the one that makes the most amount of sense to me, and therefore I'm willing to support it.
Okay, thank you. Any other comments? Mr. Rosenbaum?
Mr. Chair, I just have a question, perhaps with staff or okay. Member. Given that this does have an accelerated effect, I'm looking at the amount for schools alone in this biennium looks like $400,000. Will this have the effect of making less money be on the table in the negotiations currently going on over school funding?
Representative Rosenbaum, I don't know if I can really answer that. I mean, this is definitely going to just lower the property taxes that they will be able to collect, and then that means that they will have to get, if they do not get additional general fund money, they will not get, you know, the amount that will be allocated then is going to be less statewide then. I mean, it's just going to lower the amount of property taxes for the school district. So they get backfilled, but it's backfilled by a set amount that is established in the general fund money. So if you lower everyone's property taxes, the total amount that all schools are going to get may be a bit lower if you don't appropriate additional money in order to compensate for this.
Which we're not doing.
Right. That's my understanding.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm happy to support this bill as a bill that helps maintain a competitive business environment in Oregon. To me, it's rather persuasive that all the other states in which the United States have eliminated this form of taxation. And it's not a question of just doing it because they did it, but it's a matter of maintaining a competitive business environment, which is important to all Oregonians. So I see this bill as a positive step in that direction.
Any further comments? Please call the roll.
Representative
Thorpe. Aye.
Representative
McFarland. No. Representative Satterley. Aye. Representative Dr. Satterley. Aye. Dr. Satterley. Aye. 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 Senate Bill 559 moves to the floor of the due pass recommendation. Senator Rasmussen, would you mind carrying the bill?
It'd be my pleasure.
Okay, thank you. Close the work session on Senate Bill 559.
I thought I was going to change that.
You made the motion, so you get the pleasure.
That's okay. That's the duty of the vice chair. Motion going. Except the ones you don't like.
Okay, we'll now open the work session on Senate Bill 497.
Yeah.
Why don't you tell us what that's all about?
Okay. Chairman, so back to members of the committee, just so you're kind of refresh your memory of what we have here in Senate Bill 497. This is a protect bill, which is going to allow a property tax exemption for tax years 1992 to 93 and 93-94 for Aquatech trucks equipped with sewer cleaners that are held by lease or lease purchase agreement by a sanitary authority. So what happened with the Roseburg Urban Sanitary Authority is they failed to file a correct application with the county, and so they were charged 1992, 93, and 93-94 property taxes. Then since this has been quite a few years now, in May 1998, the bank that owned the equipment actually paid the taxes to the Douglas County of $7,796. So what this measure is going to be doing, like the dash one and the dash two together, they would be allowing a refund of taxes and interest that would be made to the bank, which owns Aquatech and paid the taxes. But then the dash two adds in that the leasee sanitary authority would be required to pay a late filing fee of $200 each year for the 1992, 93, and 93, 94 tax years. So that would reduce the tax impact $400. So there was a lot of discussion about the actual agreement, the contract between the sanitary authority and the bank, and whether or not to pass along that tax benefit. And so that's kind of how we ended it last time.
Okay. And then we also have a couple other amendments.
Yeah, I have a few.
No, no, no. All right. Gil, are you speaking about the bill as it is with your dash two or about the proposed additional amendments?
To speak about the dog rather than the tail, ride the dog.
Okay.
Yeah. I brought copies of the amendments. I don't know if you need them.
I have them in my file. I'm just here. Numbers.
Four.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Gil Riddell, Association of Oregon County staff, I just want to make the point that the late filing fee, the dash two, seems eminently reasonable when you consider that other taxpayers would have to pay this if they filed late and after a few weeks or months, and this has been 5 or 6 years, it's a modest amount.
but it will help defer the cost of administration of this locally. The dash fours clarify an ambiguity in the draft. It's unclear whether interest is to be refunded because at one line it says it is, and then another line it implies that it's not. Our dash four amendments would provide that interest would not have to be refunded.
Okay, any questions for Gil, Mr. Chairman?
So what is the logic of not, if we're going to refund the taxes, of not refunding the interest?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Wick, remember that if you decide to pass this bill in original form, you would be ignoring that the application wasn't filed for 2 years as required by statute. You'd have to ignore that for those 2 years, the lease did not reflect the savings, which was required by statute, savings of the property tax exemption. Three, you'd have to ignore that the appeal was denied by the Department of Revenue. If you go ahead and do it anyway, it would be your decision. We would as soon prefer that you not require a refund of interest. We don't think it's merited, but it's your decision.
Other questions? Okay, thank you very much. We also have John Tess.
Mr. Chairman, for your record, Bill Linden, Oregon Historic Property Association. I'm here just to introduce Mr. Chess, who's representing that association, and is going to talk to you about the details of the Dash 9 and Dash 10 amendments. The Historic Property Association is a statewide association of owners of commercial and residential properties, and we have some suggestions in these amendments that we think will improve that program. And with that, I'd like to introduce Mr. Chess.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Tess. I'm the president of the Oregon Historic Property Owners Association. The sole purpose of the Historic Property Owners Association is the preservation and of Oregon's historic resources. Its membership, as Bill has said, is made up of members of owners of historic properties throughout the state. And we've been together for some time in the early 1980s. The amendments that we have before you today in the Dash 9 amendments and the Dash 9 amendments are basically the same amendments that were passed in the 1997 legislative session at the House and died in the Senate because we ran out of time in the last session. But these amendments were amendments that had been agreed upon by all the preservation community, and we had worked through all of those issues. My background in historic preservation started with the City of Portland. I worked for the Landmarks Commission there, then I worked for the Oregon State Historic Preservation Office, and now I work on preservation issues throughout the country. What I'd like to do is walk you through Dash 9 and Dash 10 amendments and answer any questions that you might have. A lot of the issues in the Dash 9 amendments are technical corrections that needed to occur. Oregon's special assessment tax law has been around since 1975. It's probably been the most successful law in the country, and it's acted as a sample for other pieces of legislation throughout the country. Almost every state right now has some type of legislation. Unfortunately, as a result of our seismic upgrading from Seismic Zone 2B to Seismic Zone 3, and changes made by the Measure 50, which limit the economic incentives to rehabilitate, changes need to be made to the law that will give some kind of incentive to continue this program. The first changes that I'll explain is that are on page 1 of the Dash 9 amendments, which take and clarify that maintenance is part of the preservation plan that needs to be submitted, and also that preservation activities can be part of the preservation plan. On page 3, this is another technical correction that has been discussed with the State Historic Preservation Office and they agreed to. It's just when can you make application and when is your property deemed to be historic. On page 5, applications, sometimes people will make application of a special assessment or when they're trying to save a building, it's determined that the building can't be saved for seismic issues or for whatever issues. This is a technical correction that would allow, if the application had not been processed or anything else, that the applicant would in fact get 50% of the feedback for the application. The next, moving down to line 20 through 26, it clarifies that the committee cannot put conditions on an application that require property owners to do more work than what the incentive might be worth. And this is a direct result of both the size of the changes that happened with the upgrade of the seismic code and because of Measure 50 that have greatly diminished the economic incentive available in this bill. Then the other changes that you see here are technical corrections, and some of them are corrections that were needed as a result of Measure 50 and some of the terminology that changed as a result of Measure 50. Then that moves us to the Dash 10 amendments, and they deal with two specific situations that have arisen. I sat on the governor's task force for seismic rehabilitation, and we looked at the different issues, and it came up with there's a very big problem with unreinforced masonry buildings or just historic buildings throughout the state. The cost to rehabilitate just for that particular issue is anywhere from $10 to $40 for a regular building, depending if there's people in it. And some of the costs that we had seen and examples we had seen for, like, hospitals, sometimes the rehabilitation costs are up to $90 a square foot, when typically you can totally rehabilitate a building from anywhere from $60 to maybe $100, $120 a square foot. And if you add that amount of money on top of it, it really reduces the incentives to rehabilitate existing buildings. Throughout the state, we've been seeing buildings coming down as a result of the seismic code and the lack of any kind of incentives. In the last legislative session, task force did try to get some incentives put in place for seismic. This was one of the changes that occurred in this bill earlier on did help that, but it didn't go to the extent that we needed. What this does then is it does not penalize people for rehabilitating older historic buildings. There are two changes. One, it would not penalize people for adding housing to an existing historic building. And many times, even the city of Salem is a good example. You have your downtown, you have a lot of 2-3-story buildings. Someone might want to come in and put some housing on top. However, because of the seismic requirements and the lack of the incentive for historic properties, they may choose to take that one historic building out of a street front and tear it down and put some build to the highest and best use on that site. This would not penalize people for doing that, and the people would have to go through the same intensive review by the State Historic Preservation Office in order to make sure that that new construction was compatible with the historic building. So in many instances, you may see people saving a historic building and providing the housing that throughout the state we're trying to, see people come more and more back into the city. The second incentive portion of this deals with new construction that would not exceed the net rentable available square footage that was available to the building to begin with. In cases of large warehouse buildings, which were built for warehousing, what happens is that quite often you need to provide light to the interior to either provide office or to provide housing. In the case of commercial redevelopment, what this would do is say, okay, we're going to allow you to take some of the square footage away, but we'll allow you to build it back, but we're not going to tax you for that new construction, because it would have been something that would have been within the original envelope of the building to begin with. But anything outside of that for a commercial building, it will be taxed at the new value. So those are, that pretty much explains both the dash 9 and the dash 10, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have about either of those.
Okay.
Mr. Sash, can you tell us about, is this in your dash 9, is it changing at all, like when they commercial properties reapply for their second term if they choose to? How is their closing value then treated? Is it then reset at the new assessed value, or is it kept at their original frozen value 15 years ago?
I'm not sure how that's treated here. Right now, I know that there are some, there's some question right now as to whether or not, and there's been some legal cases right now that are pending, you know, with respect to when people make reapplication. Is it to be at the old frozen value, or is that the new value?
So this doesn't clarify that, or?
Mr. Chairman, counsel, there's a recent tax court case that essentially, if I understand it correctly, ruled that the old value is the one that's applied in the new period. And my understanding, Multnomah County did not appeal that decision, so for at least for now, that is the law. We're not attempting to change that one way or the other with the Dash 9 or Dash 10 amendments.
Any other questions, Representative Rosenbaum?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Gentlemen, I'm not an expert, and it's been a while since we considered doing away with historic property exemptions, and we got besieged with mail at that time. But is it the case now that new construction on certified property is not eligible for that same tax treatment across the board?
That is correct, except in the case of if it's required that you put like a penthouse on, or if there's some structural work that has to be done to the building to hold up the building, or if it's some code-related issue, say, for example, if you put an elevator on the exterior of the building or something like that, that, in fact, would qualify for the special assessment.
Not if you were adding on to something or converting into condos or whatever.
That's correct. Well, if you're converting to condos, if you had a building you were converting to condos, the building would be allowed to set up assessment.
The building
itself. That's correct.
Not the construction.
Not the new construction. What this does is it limits, what happens is in the case of a building that's being rehabilitated, you have to go through design review from the State Historic Preservation Office, and they either accept or reject and see the addition to determine whether or not that addition is compatible with the building. There are limitations set within those guidelines that will now allow usually more than a one-story addition to one two-story addition to any historic structure. You get a two-story addition, you'd have to have a very, very tall building, and the additions are usually pulled back quite a bit. What's happening is because of the seismic law and the upgrading of seismic zone 3, the cost of the buildings have been going up, and the cost to rehabilitate has gone up. So in order to recoup the cost, you have to increase the square footage somewhat to be able to make your numbers work and make it viable to rehabilitate rather than just tear the building down and build a whole new structure. There's been many instances that where there's been buildings torn down and buildings of almost the same height or maybe two or three stories higher put back in their place, and we've lost the historic structure, and it's changed, you know, what's gone on. And secondly, in terms of the new construction on the on a commercial building, you're really not changing what you would be taxed on because you're not changing the net rentable square footage of the building. What you're doing is you're providing light and air to the building, something that you would be required to by code, and so the amount of the square footage that you're being taxed on, so for example, if you take away 100 feet in the middle of the building that you can't use and you're just putting it in a different place, you're really not increasing the square footage of the building. The square footage of the building is remaining the same, and you're retaining the historic structure.
Just a final question, Madam Chair. In Section 4 of your Dash 10 amendment, it looks like you're making these changes retroactive to 1995 for residential property.
That's correct.
What's the justification for doing that?
There, there is one property that has been affected by this. They have not been, and this is one of the reasons to clarify what's going on. They have not been, they've been not taxed on that new construction. And now the question is, should they be taxed on a new construction? They've been under the special assessment program, and this clarifies that and resolves that the issue. But this is the only building in question. So there's no situation where the tax, any taxing authority is going to have to go back and pay anyone any back taxes or give up any revenues that they've already taken in.
Just to clarify, I'm not sure I follow that. You mean they should have been taxed on that construction and were not? Now you're asking us to make this new provision let them off the hook for the taxes that should have been applied?
I don't know if they should have or they shouldn't have, but it was unclear. And at the time when the assessor did the tax, applied the tax to the building, the that portion of this construction was not taxed. It's a very small, it's a small portion on the top of a building. There's, it included some code-required work that included an elevator penthouse and some other work up there, and then there are several housing units up that are up there also.
I guess I don't follow the, how this could be, that could be the only situation this retroactivity would apply to. It sounds like it would apply to any new construction that happened since 1995
for housing,
for residential property.
That's correct, for any housing.
Has a pretty wide effect beyond just that one case you described, doesn't it?
In looking, there are there's something over 900 buildings that are taking advantage of special assessment. In looking at that, and I'm pretty familiar with what's going on in terms of preservation, this is the only situation that we are aware of where this situation exists.
Any further questions? Is there a fiscal on this?
Representative Sephora, I haven't seen these amendments until right now, so yeah, I haven't done anything.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much. And that's just any closing comments there?
No, thank you very much.
I don't have the witness list in front of me. Do we have anybody else who wishes to testify in Senate Bill 497? Go ahead and come forward. Must be summer.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Marge Kofori, representing the City of Portland. Like you, we haven't had a chance to look at these amendments because they have just arrived here today, and so there is no fiscal on them. We are familiar with this issue because we worked on this issue last session. We opposed this particular amendment last session, and as the proponent described to you, the amendment failed in the last hours of the session. It appears to me, in a very quick reading, that the amendment on page 9 of the dash 9s would extend the assessment for condominium conversions from the current 15 years to 30 years. That was the particular issue that we were concerned about last session. The issue that we brought to the last session of the legislature was that by offering us a double amount of assessment period for condominium conversions, it would tend to stimulate the conversion of low-income housing to condominium conversions and thereby jeopardize our stock of low-income housing in the City of Portland. Furthermore, we are concerned that the marketplace in Portland for all kinds of condominiums is very, very hot. We think that the marketplace itself provides adequate incentives for the conversion of condominiums because we can hardly keep them in the market right now because the marketplace is so hot. And so I'm not sure of the efficacy or the importance of this particular assessment at this particular time. We're also concerned that we haven't had an adequate policy discussion of an issue of this kind. There may be unintended consequences in these amendments, both in the dash 9s and the dash 10s, that we are unaware of. the State Historic Preservation Office is not here, and as far as I know, is not aware of today's hearing, so has not had an opportunity to either look at these amendments or to converse with this committee about what their effect would be. And for all of these reasons, one other thing I would like to mention to the committee, we do provide assessment programs in the city of Portland, special assessment programs in order to stimulate low-income housing and the production of housing, whether it be rental or market-based housing. This particular extension to a 30-year from a 15-year for condominium conversions is three times the amount of period that we allow for other incentive programs, which are generally limited to 10 years and which generally sunset after a period of 10 years. So this would be three times the period off the tax rolls for condominium conversions of historic buildings. And as I said before, it is twice the amount of time that is available for typical housing in historic buildings, residential housing in historic buildings. For all these reasons, we would urge, if I am reading these amendments correctly, that you oppose them at this time, that we have a discussion in the interim with the proponents about whether these kinds of incentives are necessary and how adequately to address them. Thank you.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, Lynn McNamara from the League of Oregon Cities, to echo Mrs. Kafori's statements, particular concern would be the retroactivity. Again, I haven't seen any of this, but if I'm reading the top of page 10 in the dash 9 amendments correctly, it also appears that a change is being made to say that the rules that are adopted for these, the value, the minimum amount that has to be cumulatively invested can only equal the amount of the tax break. So there's no, it appears that an incentive is being taken away to invest any more than one would receive in the frozen tax arrangement here. We don't know what the revenue impact is of this. We think that if it was a good idea, and it may very well be a good idea for certain changes, that it would have been a good idea to discuss it, and it would have been a good idea to bring it forward before this late date in the session. So we would oppose it on that basis.
Okay. Any questions?
This is something I think that you referred to. When we were doing the historic property tax exemption early in the session, that is only a 10-year exemption. Is that what I'm understanding from your testimony?
Madam Chair, Representative Corey, are you speaking of the historic property tax exemption for residential properties only? It's a 15-year currently.
Okay. Thank you.
Any further questions?
Thank you.
Representative Merkley.
Sure. How long would it take us to get financial revenue impact?
Representative Merkley, are you talking about like today?
I'm asking what's possible for what would be possible.
I'd really have to go back to my office and look at what data I currently have on historical property. I don't know that I have condos broken out to be able to look at how many of those and if you extended that for another 15 years. So I know that's one issue.
Thank you.
Any further discussion, testimony, where we're at? Well, Mr. Chair, we're taking testimony. My sense, we're ready to figure out if we want to move forward on this bill or not move forward on this bill.
Yeah. Why don't we, I assume the testimony was about the historic properties component of
yes.
And the city's objection to it.
And the cities are indeed objecting to it. We do not have a revenue count, and it might be something that might be good to hold off on and do a little more interim work.
Well, let me ask the committee, let's back up a second. Are you okay with the county amendments for the original 487 bill on the sewer truck? That's any good?
Mr. Chairman, I'm supportive of the dash 1 and the dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 497. That would provide a refund of the taxes and the interest, but it would require the claimant to pay the $200 fee per year, which I think is appropriate to assist the county in terms of the cost of processing this refund.
Okay. Other comments?
Mr.
Shuttering?
I'm inclined the dash twos and fours. As I recall, this is one where I think this is kind of a bailout. No matter what we do here, I think we are supposed to just put some limits on the extent of the bailout. I don't want to do something here that creates a precedent that makes it too attractive for us to be dealing with this year's bill next time. I think this is
actually
a reasonable way to do it.
If fewer of them this time, then we've had...
Yeah, we have. Yeah.
We almost fixed all the problems in the text.
that's my opinion, I guess. I think this is one that... this is not a fault of the tax code or a problem in the mistake on the part of the county. I think this is a taxpayer overlooking, basically just misinterpreting what the law was and what the law required. And so for us to provide some benefit, I think we want to find the quality of mercy is not trained. But I think it's appropriate to put limits on it. I think twos and fours do that appropriately.
Okay, Mr. Chairman. Say what?
When we talk about interest here, we're talking about the interest that the taxpayer has to pay to the county. Isn't that correct, Mr. Chairman? We're not talking about interest that the county is paying back to the taxpayer. We're talking about interest that the taxpayers have to pay to the county.
Representative Witt, this is, there was $7,000 and $796 paid to Douglas County from the bank. And so you're going to either be paying back $4,400 or that full $7,700.
Okay. So the $7,000 includes the interest?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Mr. Chairman?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you're ready for a motion, but I'm going to have to disagree with Representative Shetterly. And if we're going to give the relief under the bill, let's give the relief and give the $200 per year to the county so that the county can at least cover its costs in terms of processing this mistake on the part of the taxpayer.
Is there a comment?
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I'm not in support of this bill. I think that we... Well, I just the Laura Atterbury case comes to mind, and we didn't forgive her for her taxes, and I'm not quite sure why we should forgive this taxpayer for their taxes.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Witt,
there's a difference here in that this taxpayer, if they had followed things properly, would not have owed the taxes, whereas Ms. Atterbury did owe the taxes but wasn't billed. They are not analogous situations, and I think that this case, we don't have to provide the relief, but it's clear that if this had been done properly and the paperwork had been done properly, the taxpayer would not have had to pay the tax. Mr. Chairman, I would move the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 497.
Okay. Representative Witt moved the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 497. Mm-hmm. We're going to take about a 2-minute recess.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
We're in recess. For due diligence and conversations, I'm closing the work session on Senate Bill 497.
Okay. Where are you going to be?
And I'll now open a work session on House Bill 2753.
Did you just close?
Yeah, you just closed. Thank you, Elizabeth.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Okay, we'll reopen the work session on Senate Bill 497. Representative Witt, withdraw your motion, please?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I withdraw my motion on the dash one amendment.
Representative Witt withdraws his motion on the dash one amendment. No further discussion. The work session is closed. Okay, we're now in the work session on House Bill 2753.
6 and 7.
Steve, would you tell us where we are, please?
Mr. Chair, members, you should have in front of you House Bill 2753-3 amendments dealing with the local option.
I'm sorry, dash what?
3-3, dated 6/14/99. That the content of the bill is in the dash 3 amendment. You should also find a table titled Local Option Property Tax. Has numbers, and then there's also a revenue impact fee.
Does everybody have all those items?
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry. H3's local option property tax, financial summary, and a revenue impact stream.
We're not sure yet.
This is what local option property tax is.
Yeah, I got that. Mm-hmm. And what's the third one, Mr. Chairman?
Mm-hmm. Your revenue impact statement. On the dash 3 amendment, looks like this. Okay.
All right. The amendment basically gives school districts the local option authority that they do not now have. You'll see that in Section 1, Sub 2, lines 11, where it deletes the language common or union high school districts. That wasn't an exception that is now taken out. So school districts would have local option authority. EFTs would not in this bill. The way the local option is handled is that it would also first apply to the 2000-2001 year. It would start in the second year of the biennium. The way this is handled is that if you go to bottom of page 6, top of page 7, it has the limits. If they impose a local option tax, then what is not included as local revenue for the formula, it's the lesser of the three items there. It's the gap amount, or 10% of the formula revenue. The general purpose grant, the transportation grant, and the facility grant, which is state and local dollars, 10% of the state and local dollars allocated by the formula for the district, or $500 per extended ABMW, or whatever is the smaller of those three. Now, and then there's also language on top of page 2 that says if they get local option authority that the voters have approved, but choose to not use all of it, the district could do that. So it gives them, if, for example, one of the limits were less than what the voters approved, then they could decide to levy less and stay within the limit. So what's happening here is that the limits are on the local option revenue that gets excluded from the local revenue used in the equalization formula. If the local option revenue should raise more than the limit, then that becomes local revenue in the formula, would reduce their state school fund dollars, and essentially spread that statewide, whatever the amount over the limit was. So there's a strong incentive here to stay within the limit. And
okay.
That's the approach used in this bill.
Okay. Any questions or comments on the dash 3s? Steve, is there anywhere in the amendments a limit on the time that these taxes are imposed?
No, there's not. There's no sunset or other types of limits on the seeking voter approval.
So
they would still have to comply with all the constitutional provisions dealing with local option and the statutes. So if depending on which election they chose, for example, there might be a double majority requirement.
Mm-hmm. But I meant to once the local option is in place, it's in place forever and until repealed?
In the statutes, yes. There's still the limit of the 5 years for operating local options and 10 years for capital local options
constitution. So they could have...
Okay, so it's 5 years duration once approved by the voters. That has to exist for 5 years
for operating
durations, and then it goes away and it has to be revoted on.
Yes. But I assume that they could have more than one at the same time. If the gap allowed it.
For different districts?
Well, possibly for the same district.
Okay. Well, the only reason I ask is that this was one of the conditions that was requested by House leadership, was that there be a limited duration on the amount that could be collected under a voter approved local option. In other words, it wouldn't be forever.
Sure.
The Constitution limits that to 5 for operations in chance of capital.
Correct. Yeah. I think if I understand these comments, that if they approve one year up to the gap, and then they're additional gap room is developed, and in 3 years down the road they could go out and levy that gap. If you'd have overlapping ones, but they didn't, each have been separately approved.
But assuming that the first one would last for 5 years,
right,
if it was for operations, and then it would
Yeah.
So then there would be more gaps to go back out and ask it again.
Do that?
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Merkley.
I want to, in form of commenting on the dash 3, I wanted to note that I have a dash 4 that would modify the structure of the dash 3, and I would yield to the chair at the appropriate time to distribute and discuss that might be.
Well, I don't think there is an appropriate time, but you can distribute them now if you want.
Okay.
Well, these are good.
Mr. Chair, while that's happening, can I just ask a clarifying question of the staff?
Sure.
Steve, I'm not sure I quite understand this parentheses to 10% of revenue from the equalization formula and $500 per weighted student. It's the lesser of parentheses 1 or parentheses 2. Now, are those two different sets of figures in 2?
It's the lesser of the three items listed there.
So it's really like that 500 per student is really a third.
Yes, it is.
It's written in a little confusing way, I think. Shouldn't it properly be like a parentheses 3, and it would be the lesser of 1, 2, or 3?
Are you looking at the revenue impact?
Well, I'm looking at the staff
name. It does say or. It does say or in the bill.
It does? Yeah. Okay. So the language is clear, but the summary is a little bit unclear.
I know what you mean.
Oh, I see what you're
saying. The bill, I checked it. The bill does say more.
Revenue impact. Okay. Representative Mercury, what do you have?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the issues that's not revealed when we look at the chart of counties is that counties may have to tax themselves disproportionately to produce a certain amount of funds per student. Based on the property tax base per student in the district. So if one can quickly get their hands around, if you have a very large property tax base per student, a small amount of taxes brings in a whole lot more money than if you have a very low level of property tax base per student. And this is one of the inequities that folks around the state have been very concerned about in returning to a property tax system as a way of augmenting school funding. There is a strategy that was talked about in the interim, was in one of the interim studies. We talked about it earlier in this committee, called power equalization. It's also been referred to as the Kansas plan because Kansas implemented this. It balances out that inequity by compensating poor districts or in terms of their property tax base per student when they tax themselves to provide local funds. And the way that it works is crudely like this. If you have you identify a target district, which is roughly the 75th percentile from least rich to richest, and if that target district had, and I'll just use four example numbers, may not bear any relation to reality, but But if it had a property tax base of $10,000 per student for ADM, and then you had a poor district that was below the target and had only $5,000 property tax base per student, and so you take the difference per student in property tax base, you multiply it times the number of students as measured by ADMs, and then you multiply it times the tax rate that has been approved under this local option, under the local option as it stands now. The difference, that amount of money would then be paid in a grant to the poor districts. So essentially the poor districts, when they tax themselves, would be able to tax themselves and receive money as if they were a more affluent in terms of property tax base per student. And this makes the use of the property tax a much fairer instrument for this purpose. This amendment is pretty straightforward, as you can see, and it lays it out, that formula out, and this is written so that it would kick in the year 2001. Essentially, we had testimony previously that very few school districts would be able to exercise the local option in the next 2 years. I would certainly be fine structuring this so that those that could use their local option within the next 2 years without the property, without the power equalization formula. But I think it's very important to establish the principle that we will kick in the power equalizations when this really comes into existence, which for most districts will be 2 years from now.
Hey, Ozzy Rose and Lori Wimmer wanted to speak on this. You're setting the rate.
Ready?
Go ahead.
Good morning. For the record, Lori Wimmer with the Oregon Education Association. And we've been working with Representative Merkley and others on this committee on this concept because the Oregon Education Association has believed, as we've testified to this body before, that a local option could provide another arrow in our quiver of means to provide resources to districts. But we would hate to see that done for the few at the expense of the many. We believe that this amendment in the Dash 4s represents a successful and meaningful way to ensure that the march to equity that Oregon has undertaken in the last few years remains in law, even subsequent to the passage of a local option, should it go all the way. This amendment does that because it enables districts without a high industrial base or high affluent areas to essentially provide this resource to their students as well if voters choose to pass a local option. Mechanically, the way it works in Kansas, our association colleagues there assure us, is very, very well. And so we believe that, once again, as this body struggles with all the different aspects of tax policy in the state of Oregon and the frustrations with those I know you've all confronted, this provides a real solution that doesn't disadvantage the many at the expense of the few. And so we would urge your adoption of these amendments.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, for the record, and Mr. Penny, I'm Ozzy Rowe for the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. And if you recall, I testified earlier in the session that our association is opposed to a local option until there's adequate and equitable funding. But that if we move in the local option direction, the Kansas plan was a very desirable way to place the limits. The one difference is a full power equalization plan. You would take money away from the districts at the higher level to pay for those passing lower levels, and I don't think that would make very good sense in the politics of trying to pass levies. And for the proposal before you says that those who are above the so-called target level would keep whatever they were able to pass with their voters, and those that were below that level, which are the ones that are concerned about being run over again like our old days of inequitable funding because of the wealth difference in districts, you would support them, you'd provide an incentive for those folks to pass those extra levy. So I think the proposal is a better set of limits and a better way to go. And if you're going to go in the local option direction, I would encourage you to adopt these amendments.
Is there any way to know what the fiscal impact on the state would be? We don't know how many districts would avail themselves of this. We don't know what the range would be of the gap that the state would have. That's what concerns me about this, is not knowing 4 years or 6 years down the road what the extent of the state's obligation might be if we make this available.
Mr. Chair, Richard Sherman, that's correct. You have no idea how many will pass them. The issue evolves again around folks' fear of the days when Josephine County had $3,000 and somebody else had $6,000 a kid. I also shared with you on a test I buy before that the views I share may or may not be my own views on this issue, but I do work for immigration. And there is great fear among those who were the poor that we've come very close to having full equity, and we're going to turn around and turn up loose, and we'll be poor again because we'll never pass levies anyway. And whether that fear is that we're talking about smaller amounts, there's a variety of ways to argue this, and I don't know the answers, but bottom line, you don't know the commitment you'd be making to subsidize those.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I might add, and Representative Shirley, that's one of the reasons we made this go into effect in the 2001-2003 biennium. It certainly isn't a matter on the table for this upcoming biennium. It's also true, I believe, just judging from the way, even with voter behavior and so forth, that this would be incremental and slow over time, over a lot of years. You'll have occasional districts here, there, and everywhere, but it's not going to be that all of a sudden 198 school districts are putting these on the balance. It's not practical. We think that, particularly given the recent voter patterns with respect to property taxation.
I might amplify a couple related points. One is, you can see from the chart that there are a number of school districts that will have very little incentive. And even though that might gain $100 or $200 per student, an awful lot of community challenge to go out and pass a levy on that basis. The other reason that we chose the 75% percentile target rather than making it, say, the richest district in the state is because it cuts off the end of the bell curve of some very rich districts that would make this a very expensive strategy. And so that helps to moderate that expense factor.
Well, I appreciate this is one way to try and maintain equity within the local option, but the Dash 3 amendments also attempt to maintain some semblance of equity, too, by the limitation on the extent to which the local option can be, that is, the revenue that can be raised for the local option. And that's an alternative way of doing it that doesn't implicate state general fund requirements. I would agree, I think, if there was no limitation on the local option in the Dash 3 amendments so that the Riverdale is out there raising $15,000 per student or whatever they get, we'd have some serious problems. But it seems to me we've tried to address that anyway in the Dash 3 by putting some limits on what communities can raise. And I understand that doesn't help the communities on the low end get money, but if at least ratchets in the upper end districts and is going to keep them from advancing themselves too far forward and getting ourselves in that pre-1990 situation.
Mr. Chair, if I might respond to that, and this is Representative Shetterly. The concern is, however, that it would take very little effort for a Dunthorpe in Southwest Portland or some of these other more affluent areas to affix just a small amount of money to the property tax, 50 cents per 1,000 assessed value, to get to the cap in their gap. Whereas in a poorer neighborhood, they might have to double their property taxes in order to achieve the same amount of dollars. And that's the problem that this one tries to address.
Mr. Chair. Mr. Rose, I think your original testimony was that your position was
who were opposed to a local option previously until we had reached an adequate level of funding. I'm assuming you don't think that has happened yet?
Mr. Chair, Representative Roosevelt. No, ma'am. Our association people are both adequacy and equitable question. And there's an awful lot of folks that aren't satisfied that they have this. And very careful. And President Shirley's remark, to be very accurate, there is a limit in the bill you proposed. The issue is whether it's the best limit or better limit or whatever. And what they proposed in this other set of minutes is more consistent with what our folks.
Just to clarify, I imagine you've picked up the same reactions that I have when I've been out talking to people, that some people really hate the idea of a local option because they don't see their district could ever benefit and some could benefit. Is your feeling about the dashboard that it offsets that because it does provide some pathway for poor districts that they might be able to take some advantage of this at some point in the future?
Out in the districts, the feelings are very intense. The proposal here does modify those. Unfortunately, everybody's all over the map on the issues because your earlier question, is it adequate? You go look at 486, 489, all these different numbers, you find lots of school districts that don't believe they can run next year and the following year at the same level they're running now. So, one year in sight. These kind of changes are very difficult to buy.
Representative Welsh.
Mr. Chairman. Ozzie and Lori. Just the subject of the local option and the proposition to vote for, vote against, is very difficult for me to do either way in my district. But what about those who brought us ballot measure 5 and ballot measure 47? What about their intent within their legislation, their ballot measures, and the challenge we would have by passing either of these? Would there be possible future lawsuits because of that? And we'd be countering their intent in that legislation. Has there been much discussion of that?
Sure, Mr. Welsh. We put out a Constitution Amendment, Measure 50, and I believe it allowed the local option within the $5 for all other governments. And you legislatively prohibited that right to school. So I don't think there's a, now how people feel about it, your question whether there's any lawsuits or constitutional, I don't think so, because we've already, through the Constitution, allowed it. You just legislatively prohibited it at the time you put out measure.
However, Mr. Chair, Representative Welsh, the fact of the dash threes might introduce some concerns about lack of equity over time, which is, again, why we introduced the dash fours, so that we would have a way of lessening that possibility.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Thompson.
Thank you. Representative Jerry Thompson, representing the District 4 on the Oregon coast. I haven't had a chance to look over the amendments, but I can tell you my philosophy has been for local option is it's a bad deal. I can't imagine any amendments that will make it satisfactory for a district on the Oregon coast. And part of it's caused by your retired people from the other districts. You send your retired people to the Oregon coast, and they don't want to pay taxes when they get there because they're on fixed income. Consequently, I can't imagine a forum where local option would ever pass in my district because of the situation. We have gone as many as 20 years in a growing society and never been able to pass a school bond because of the high retirement community. That's simply the way it is. If you want to treat kids equally throughout the state, you will stay away from a local option. And that's what I'm here to tell you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Witt.
Thank you. Representative Thompson, in view of the fact that some districts are ready, willing, and able to pass local option taxes, go above the current equalization formula that provides the necessary funding for those schools. Do you think the fact that this will cause some districts to have more funding than others is justification to block those districts and those communities from providing the funding that they need?
I'll answer your question indirectly, but I think I'll answer your question. What happens is, in order to get adequate school funding in this state for all of us, it takes all of us in here pulling together. And when you take and seal off a few districts and make them satisfied, the poor districts will suffer because they'll be over here crying for money while other people are satisfied. Now, I think I answered your question, but maybe not as directly as you'd like.
Okay. Other questions? Mr. Chairman Williams, I just want to point out that as some of those people are heading towards Newport, they pull over and buy places in King City in my district. Just wanted to point that out.
I've got a couple mobile home courts in mind.
They don't make it all the way to the coast sometimes. That traffic on 99, they don't want to drive through Newport, so they just stop.
I appreciate the situation we're all in the state of Oregon. We're all trying to help our school districts, but you can see the problems that we have on the coast because we do have probably the highest retirement community over there and proportion to the population. So I hope we can still all keep pulling together, and I see local option is one of those things that will pull us apart.
St. Thompson, what's the school district in Newport? What's the name of it?
Lincoln. Frankfort.
Is it Lincoln?
Lincoln. Lincoln County is the whole.
Yeah, okay.
We have one countywide school district, which creates some problems too. Ask me the numbers.
If I'm looking those things up, you might also look at Willamina and in terms of other school districts in the Amhill area. And those are timber-dependent communities, which is an even tougher area, I think, to do any sort of local property tax work. Those are communities that appear to be very marginal, very much on the margin these days. And you look at going to Willamina, there's like $1 number for ADM. There's some real issues around balances of these things, and I'm not entirely settled as to the quality of those things or not. And certainly the representative has spoken multiple times towards a Willamina community not being able to even take care of basic maintenance issues when they know that they have physical defects in their school buildings. And they're still a timber-dependent community, and the cash flow in which does not allow them to do even the fundamentals, let alone any extensions, if I understand the situation correctly.
Exactly. Perfect.
Okay.
Thank you.
Representative Hobson, are you here to speak on something? Any other representatives in the room that I have missed? Yeah, there were a couple. Vicki Totten is also my next speaker.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Vicki Totten, Oregon Community College Association. I'm not quite sure how to approach this with your amendments, but I think I know how to make it clear. And my testimony is coming, and I need the picture on the second page to help you understand my point here. Last session, when you were implementing Measure 50, you gave community colleges local option, but it was capped at the amount of our Measure 50 losses. That equals about $28 million statewide. For Portland Community College, that means in perpetuity without a change, the most they could ever ask for in a local option would be about $4 million. So I came to ask that you repeal the cap on the amount of taxing authority that community colleges would have with local option, and I did it with the thought that if you pass the local option for K-12, that we wouldn't get in the way of that. So our proposal, if you look at the second page in the picture, would say that if, for example, Central Oregon Community College, which is the district depicted here, passed a local option and any one of those school districts also passed a local option, then that school district would not get any less than they would get under this bill if the college had not passed a local option, that we would compress the gap in that area for that amount. That's to accommodate if you do that this way, then there wouldn't be any confusion. One of the details that we had worked out on the Senate side was that if the community colleges passed the local option and the school district did, that we would share the gap the same way that we had compressed under Measure 5. But it seems to be much simpler to just say that the school district would get what they would get if they had passed it anyway, the $500 or the 10%, whichever amount that is. If you pass your Dash 3 amendment, then what you would need to do for us is repeal ORS 280-057, which is on your first page of the bill. And because you've taken that out in your amendments and then put the stipulation in that the school district would get that amount, and that would fix the problem that we have right now.
Any questions? Thank you. Did you have an amendment drafted or anything that actually showed this language repeal?
No, I don't have an amendment drafted. I talked to you yesterday, but I can get it done quickly.
Any other questions? Thank you. Is there anyone else here who wants to speak on a local option, Jim?
Tim Herding, Portland Public Schools. Won't take a lot of time. We do want to go on the record that we do support the local option. We certainly are sympathetic with concerns of other districts. I think the thing that's important to us is to point out that we believe that we would use the local option to maintain the service level that we have, that the way the funding structure is today, the formula essentially determines the amount of revenue the district has, that any imperfection in that formula does cause problems for districts at maintaining the service level and even maintaining what we would consider an equalized service level. And this is really the only thing that's left to us, or would be the only thing left to us, to keep our class size from rising under any of the proposed funding levels that we've heard. And that's the situation that we're in. We don't have any problem with something like a Kansas plan. In fact, I know analysis was done a couple years ago on the very question as to how much subsidy it would require, and you could probably dig those out of the file. My memory was that it's not that much, but I don't, you know, that's just my memory. You'd have to go look at those numbers. Lots has happened since then. My memory may have failed. But those numbers are all available, so you can pull them out of the files if you want to look at them. But that's the situation that we're in, and so certainly we support a local option to maintain the service level that we have.
Okay, any questions for Senator Witt?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jim, wouldn't this Kansas plan potentially have a negative impact on the Portland School District if several or a number of the school districts that were below the 75 percentile passed level options, and let's say, for example, Portland didn't?
It could, yes. But, again, my memory is that the dollar amount that you're talking about, particularly this biennium, since you can't do it until the second year, and you have to get a double majority to pass anything, I just don't believe that the dollar amount would be significant. And anything you do here could be adjusted next session. And we'll go with it either way. I think that's your choice. We'll go with it either way. But I don't believe it would be significant. I don't believe, as Representative Thompson was saying, that you're going to find an avalanche of districts out there approving a local option if you, in this biennium, or even in the long-term future, if you pass this kind of legislation.
Any other questions? Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Thompson poses another question, which is more political, so you may choose to answer it or not at your own risk, but at your own discretion, I think. I think his point of view is that one of the downsides of doing local option is that we start down a path of balkanization of school funding, and that ultimately he would probably say this in different words, but that we won't all be in the same boat. Some of us will be in yachts, and some of us will be in dinghies, and it will make it much more difficult to come to any long-term permanent solution to school funding. So, and I think he believes, and I don't necessarily agree, that districts like Portland could solve all their problems this way and would just be free and clear. I'm just curious if you have any thoughts you'd care to share on that aspect of going down this road.
Well, I think it's a matter of degree. The comparison between a dinghy and a yacht is a matter of degree. And that's why you put appropriate limits on a local option. If you look at other states and the differences that exist between school districts and other states, you do have examples of dinghies versus yachts. And this proposal, neither of these proposals, would create the ability to create that difference in degree. The differences are $500 per student is at most 10% difference between one funding level and another. You could argue very easily that there are those kinds of differences in the formula now. In other words, the formula itself doesn't fully reflect, say, differences in cost in special ed or differences in urban cost, and those differences are that large. So you're just not talking about creating a situation like that exists in other states. You're talking about something that's much more at the margin because there are limits on it. And if the limits that are there are too large, you can always reduce them. Yes, so I think that's really what it boils down to, is that you really need to have some ability, because the formula is not perfect, to allow local decisions. And this may not be a perfect way to do it. You very rarely get perfection in this process.
Okay.
I guess what I might suggest, we have the dash threes in front of us, and I think that's the basic plan that we've been working off for most of the session. And I'm intrigued by the Kansas plan, is that what it is? And I would like to know more about that. I think it may have merit. I'm concerned that this is probably our last meeting, and we know what happens when we take action precipitously without the opportunity to go back and fix. I might be inclined, especially since the dash fours don't take effect until the following biennium, to go ahead and approve the dash threes and add the review of the Kansas plan to our interim work plan and take a look at that, because all statutory would be needed then to go back in there and add that to the system that we would enact with the dash three amendments. I don't want to stay open to it. I don't want to foreclose that, but I don't know that I want to make that the plan today.
Okay. Thank you very much. Anyone else here to speak? Okay, the chair would move the dash three amendments to House Bill 2753. Further discussion? Okay, well,
I certainly makes it very difficult for me to vote either way, but I stressed before, but I think the Kansas approach and what Representative Federley has certainly has merit. And I would like to be able to add something
be suggested, but I also support your motion.
Thank you. Further comment?
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Witt?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will support the Dash 3 amendments. I think one of the things that's increasingly clear is that equalization is not equal. And what the Dash 3 amendments will do is they will provide the opportunity for many districts around the state to make the case to local communities that their school districts really do need additional funds to provide the type of jobs educating our young people that the community really wants to see. And I think that importance of local responsibility and local accountability is reinforced by these amendments. It's true there will be some changes in the spending per student through this, more than you would have in the Kansas plan, but as what Representative Shetterly said earlier, is pretty persuasive. We're dealing with something on the margin here of not more than 10%, and over time that 10% will become less as the state funding level actually goes up. And the current formula really is not equal in terms of providing equal dollars, because many districts have additional costs because of the growth or because of the cost of living in those districts. I think this is a good positive step forward in terms of returning some accountability and responsibility to the local communities to fund their schools. So I'm pleased at this time to support these Dash 3 amendments.
Thank you. Okay, Rosenbaum?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm really conflicted about this, right, because I'm a school district that is clearly facing inadequate funding and having to make cuts and suggesting to be the only lifeboat out there. However, I feel pretty strongly that because we're talking about an inadequate budget overall, and because there are districts that clearly cannot make use of this because of their economy and because of their property tax base, it doesn't move us ahead in terms of an ultimate funding solution, even this session. And I threw out an appearance of doing something about a problem, but there's no real relief for anybody, let alone for everybody. So at this time, I feel I'm going to have to vote against it. And I would prefer to be voting on the Dash 4s, but I understand maybe not in the cards.
Mr. Chair, following our discussion on the and vote on the Dash 3, will I have a chance to move the Dash 4 amendment?
If the Dash 3 fails,
well, the two are not mutually exclusive. In fact, the Dash 4 was written specifically as an add-on to the Dash 3, incorporating the language of the Dash 3. And so
Well, Representative, we just tabled a bill a minute ago because amendments came in at the last minute. Members said, I'm not going to support a bill that has no revenue impact, that doesn't have more staff time, doesn't have more research. When I see a hand-engrossed amendment dropped down at the very last meeting of the Revenue Committee, I'm not inclined to then jump on board and say this will be our policy.
Yes, well, Mr. Chair, you should take full responsibility for that. You will recall that we addressed this very early in the session. And at that time, I raised this issue. You chose to give us an announcement as to consideration of this bill at the very last second, and to bring it in not only with short warning, but to bring it at the very end of the session with short warning. And when you guide the committee in that fashion, it's necessary for us to try to do good legislation within the parameters that you have established. I have tremendous objections to the Dash 3 as it stands alone. You'll recall earlier this session that I noted that we should not use the local option to provide a quality basic education to our children. And you stated in front of this body that you agreed with that, that you felt that was right. And now we're coming back and we are using the local option to do exactly that, to provide a quality basic education for only a select few of our children, those that live in districts that can pass a levy, those that live in districts that have the property tax base that makes it possible, those that live in districts that happen to have room remaining under the $5 gap. This is exactly the opposite direction of equality for our children. This does take us all out of the same boat. And 10%, by the way, is huge. A huge portion of the money in a school district goes to support the maintenance of infrastructure and all that is required. And when you get a few more percent on the margin, that ends up being teachers, and that is class size, and that is summer school and remedial help and counselors, and the very guts of what makes an education a quality basic education. Now, I am disturbed that it was chosen to take such an important issue and cram it into the last meeting. And in that context, though, we need to establish the principle that we are not simply going to do this for the well-off in our state, and that we are in the same boat, and that is what the dashboard takes at least a step in preserving, and I would encourage the opportunity to move that amendment after we address the Dash 3.
Representative, I think your comments are really pretty out of order. You've had months to draft amendments to have revenue analysis done. The issue before us today of the formula and the local option have been well known for weeks, and there's certainly no secret. There was no last-minute sneak as far as the agenda was concerned. This was well known to everybody in the building.
Well, Mr. Chair,
I don't think that there was... This is very interesting for me because I remember two sessions ago that it was the if only we had the opportunity to have a local option, and now the tables have turned. It was the Republicans who were opposed at that time. The Democrats were asking for local option as a way to re-empower local communities and so forth, and now the tables have completely switched around. Also, if we're talking about special treatment and disequity and those kinds of things, I don't recall a great deal of distress when the Portland district received $25 million in one-time money last biennium. Nobody else got that $25 million in one-time money. Nobody else got Multnomah County, City of Portland, one-time money. So I really think that your arguments are off base on that equity issue. I think there's merit in studying this other proposal. Don't have any objection with that. I think Representative Settle made a very good point that this should be something we should look at as perhaps a better adjustment. But failing the ability for us to start delving into that at this point, I think it's time to move the amendment, move the bill, get on with it.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Witt.
I just make the point so that everybody who's listening knows that this committee has known all along that at some point we were going to be dealing with this issue of local option and that we were going to be dealing with the formula. We knew these were issues that at the right time before the session was over had to come forward. So to the extent that the implication of Representative Murphy's remarks were that this is a last-minute meeting and we're trying to think something through, I rather resent that because that's not true. We've known these issues were going to be dealt with. This is the first time this morning that I've seen these Dash 4s or a Kansas plan. And you know, the implication that there's something underhanded going on here, frankly, is very, very unfair.
Okay, further discussion? Dash 3 amendments. Would you please call the roll?
Representative
Story.
Aye.
Representative Murphy.
No.
Representative Rosenbaum.
No.
Representative Shatterley.
Aye.
Representative Wells.
Aye.
Representative
Sillian.
Aye.
Representative
Smith. Aye.
No.
Aye. Next three
members
are adopted.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Just a question, not a speech.
Okay.
It seems like the community college folks are raising a pretty narrow problem. It doesn't sound controversial. Is there any opportunity to be able to address that, or is it too late?
Well, that's why I asked the question of the witness who brought the suggestion forward. If we had an amendment or sort of a draft or a reference, statutory reference that would have taken this action, I would have been willing to take a look at that. But failing that, I don't have the ability to just conceptually say wherever this provision exists, take it out or delete it. Maybe we can do that once this bill gets to the Senate. You know, we're on the fast track now that she says there was agreement in the Senate. That was the first I heard of it yesterday as well. We don't have an amendment to deal with that. If that can be worked out in the Senate, that would be fine with me.
I would certainly get in here.
Right. Okay, the chair moves House Bill 2753 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Please call the roll.
Representative Corey.
Aye.
Representative Murphy.
No.
Representative Rosenbaum.
No.
Representative Shetterly.
Aye.
Representative Wells.
Aye.
Representative Williams.
Aye.
Representative Rea.
Aye.
Vice Chair Rasmussen.
No.
Vice Chair Beck.
Aye. House Bill 2753, I'm going to go to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Chair will carry the bill. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2753.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to serve notice of minority report.
Okay, chair notice. Do you recall the announcement on Friday, I believe it was, that says minority reports have to be filed within one day?
Monday.
Whatever.
Monday.
You
know,
several days.
5 p.m. on Monday.
Okay. Yeah, maybe, Mr. Chair, it'd be good if we could clarify what that was. Staff, because I think I did the last minority report, and we had way confusion at the last minute about when it was due. I guess we can clarify it with Ramona. My understanding was it meant session day, and the next session day was Monday, so it would be 5 o'clock Monday.
Okay. Okay, we're next going to go to House Bill 2566, but before we do that, we'll take about a 5-minute recess. Steve, would you tell us what we've sketched out for this bill?
Okay, after 2566, you should have a copy of the Dash 7 Amendment, dated 7-10-99. Note that it says on here, rough draft. Council did not quite finish proofing it. And then there will also be other amendments that we've proposed. Besides the Dash 7 Amendment, I hope you can find an outline titled 1999 School Finance Legislation Proposal. I tried to list most of the components in the bills and probably can use that as well as the draft. I won't be able to find everything in the draft for you. I haven't read it through completely. You have a school formula revenue summary run, simulation 52, related to the Dash 7 Amendment. And you also have, I believe, a table revenue, school revenue proposal that tries to summarize some of the components in 2566. But there's more there than just 2566.
Okay.
All right. Yeah. I would just walk through the concept of the bill rather than the language.
Yeah, up first. Up the legislation proposal sheet.
Yes. Okay. The first thing is the EFD revenue distribution. This is important, one, because in the Senate Ways and Means Education Subcommittee, they have the Appropriation Bill 5018, I believe it is. That would set separate caps for K-12 and ESDs in terms of what the state and local dollars can be for each of those in each year the next biennium. So what is decided here on ESDs will potentially affect what those caps are in the other bill. Okay, what this does, remember that ESDs currently don't have any formula for receiving state school fund dollars without legislation.
And in the past, they've always gotten a percentage of the coffee tax losses, either from Measure 5 and Measure 50. So it's whatever that number was, that's what they got in terms of dollars and then balance in the school fund dollars. The approach here is to take the 1998 year as a base year and look at both the per student dollar amounts for ESDs and do one of two things. Either keep them at that 98-99 per weighted student dollar amount and take it times the number of students that they would have in each year of the IN. Or if they are an ESD that's below the average of 98-99, raise them up to a certain amount, again, per weighted student. And you'll find those amounts on page, first the bottom of page 2, beginning in lines 22. So you have a range from $125 for Region 10, Cook and Deschutes counties, up to $225 for Region 8, Jacksonville, Josephine, and Klamath counties. Those are for the 9 ESDs that are currently below the statewide average for ESDs. That would be an amount for each ESD, and then, of course, the state school fund portion would be that amount less the local revenue from the ESD. The first part of the bill, then, basically says how much of the state, answers the question, how much of the state school fund should be allocated for ESDs. In the past, the state school fund hasn't been divided between K-12 and ESDs. ESDs received whatever it required to fulfill their percentage of loss requirements, and what was left then was for K-12. The language here would split it so that you would have a certain portion of the state school fund for K-12 and a portion for ESDs. Okay, so there's a state school fund dollar amount, there's local revenue. Then the draft goes on to address the questions of what happens if property taxes, for example, are less than estimated, are less than what, so that there wouldn't be enough dollars to fulfill the per student guarantee. And it says that you would prorate all of the districts down. So even the districts that were listed here at $150 or $200 per weighted student could potentially be a little bit less than that if property taxes were short. It would distribute any revenue shortfall across all of the ESDs. The flip side of that that's addressed here, too, is that the per student dollar amount, whatever that adds up to, there may be more state and local revenue available than what that would call for. So there's also a provision in here that could potentially give a percentage increase to all of the ESDs. So that's the one that $150 would be slightly above that. But it's trying to balance the funds available to what the per student dollar amounts would add up to. But that would only be up to whatever the cap amount is in the appropriation bill in 5018. Those three things are going on initially with ESDs. Okay, the rest of ESD language is pretty much administration. Just like for K-12, if an ESD decides not to use its full property tax authority for purposes of calculating their local revenue, it would be calculated as though they had used their full levy. ESDs would be required to report to the Department of Education and have audits for just the 2 years in the next biennium. This is, all of these provisions are temporary for another biennium. And part of the reason for that is that the sections on ESDs set up an interim task force to study the ESD, both the functions and services that they provide, as well as the funding mechanism for those. And then there's an appropriation of $150,000 for that task force expenses that are set up by the Department of Education. Okay. That's the ESD portion. Any questions on that before
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rasmussen.
Some apologies to the group. There are dash cams distributed to us that deal with ESDs and apparently have significant agreement among ESDs and school boards and school administrators, and would like to reserve an opportunity to come back around and look at the components of the dash 10 and how they might be integrated into the dash 7.
Okay.
The facility grant that was passed in 1997, but it doesn't start until 99-01, this coming year. When it was passed, it was at 6% of the construction cost for the new facility, basically for providing some of the content for the structure. And what the original legislation said 6%, but not more than $10 million per biennium. This deletes the $10 million cap so that a full 6% would be available to those districts opening new facilities. And I'm trying to find the page that that's on.
Page 11.
Where it deletes the language in lines 21 through 25.
Question, Mr. Chair?
Chair Rosenbaum?
So we're eliminating that cap of $10 million, so this, you have to estimate how much construction there's likely to be to get the fiscal effect.
No, there's a very specific number because it's costs that are filed with the Department of Education.
Uh-huh.
So, and see that it's $13
million. 13.1
million. It can't go up like an unlimited amount if there's an anticipated new construction going on.
Well, it's related to how much actual new construction there is. If there are hundreds of new buildings being built 1 year, mm-hmm. then it would go up. I mean, there's generally, a normal replacement level. Steve said the 6% was arrived at not as a part of the construction cost, but as the essentially the idea of furnishing a new building.
Uh-huh.
In other words, you're still asking local taxpayers in a district to pay for the whole cost of the building. Let me ask, interrupt you just a second. Representative Thompson and Byer, did you want to speak now, or do you have time to... Yeah, I'm sorry. Sorry to keep you waiting.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Roger Byer, State Representative, District 28. I'm here to testify in opposition to the part of this amendment dealing with the high growth grant, and with the Portland bailout. Specifically on the high growth part, I recognize that schools and school districts that are growing have a problem building buildings. But these problems they have building buildings is the extra students they get for with the ADMW without the growth grant. This is a bonus to schools until they have to build a building. So you have, what this growth grant is doing is benefiting 28 districts in the state that need the least help. Because until they have to build that building, every student they get is an addition to them. It is the exact opposite problem when you have school districts losing students, which is what the other 170 student school districts in the state are usually facing. It's not a problem of not enough room. It's back to the fact that they are losing students. When they lose a student, that is a loss of dollars. And in many of these small schools, when they have to lose a teacher, that's not losing a teacher. That's losing a program. And that is the big issue here. When you take in this budget without the growth part, you already have a $13 million for facility grant, which was already discussed. And that $13 million goes to fund the startup costs, which there are startup costs when a new building is opened. And that's what that $13 million is to fund, the additional things that have to be done to open a new building. But until you have to open a new building, your only cost is you don't have an additional cost until you have to build and open a building. In order to build a building, and I'm going to use some figures but I tried to compare apples to apples. Most of this facility grant money in the next 2 years will go into Washington County, and most of the iGrowth grant money will go into Washington County. In Washington County, if you take the Beaverton, which is the largest school in Washington County, it costs approximately 84 cents per $1,000 of assessed valuation to build a $10 million building. In Hillsboro, it costs about $1.78 per $1,000 of assessed valuation to build a $10 million building. If you compare that to some other districts around the state that don't have the high growth problem, such as, I'm going to pick a couple in my district. In Molalla, it costs $14 per $1,000 of assessed valuation to build that same $10 million building. So in Hillsboro, you can build 19, or no, in Beaverton, you can build 19 buildings for the same cost per $1,000 of assessed valuation that you can build one in Molalla. If you take Colton, a small school in my district that would benefit from the small schools piece of this, it costs you $58 per thousand to build that same building versus 84 cents in Beaverton. So where it's true, in the high growth areas, when they have to build a building, they have to pass a bond, and they're having to pass lots of bonds there. I understand, I recognize that. But they can build 20 buildings to one in Molalla for the same cost to the taxpayer. And that's the difference. That's the issue. That's why I'm opposed to the growth factor here. Because until they have to build that building, which many of these high growth districts are going to receive this funding, they don't have to build a building, because they've had space available, they've got people there now coming in, it's a bonus to them to have these extra kids to set up their space.
Representative Beyer, schools in my district are already full to maximum. They have portables all over the athletic fields. And every time another 50, 100, 300 kids move in, they have to haul out more portables. So it's not correct to say they have available space. There definitely is immediate cost impact for these areas that are already totally maxed out. They opened a new school in Representative Witt's district, 98? And it was already full before it even opened with portables on the athletic field. So there is a capacity problem, and there is not spare room. I mean, if you're saying there's lots of room, just go ahead and stick those kids in there, and then you get the windfall of their amount per student. That's not an accurate reflection.
Mr. Chair, if I said that, I didn't mean it in that light. I said some of these 32 schools, that is the case, such as Redmond in particular, they had a one-third capacity roughly in the school. So they, in this formula, Redmond would receive, if I can find them quick, they receive $177,000, and they don't need to build a building. I understand that in Beaverton, there is a space available problem. I have portables in my schools also because they have not been able to pass a bond in order to build these buildings. They don't have space either, and they get nothing from this because they haven't reached that little threshold, whatever that magic student number is that they've had to have gained, which is probably going to be impossible for these buildings, for these districts, for other districts to ever reach that number because they don't grow that much. But yet their buildings are full, and they've got portables on their athletic fields too. But there's nothing in it for them. That's why I don't agree with that. That's why the facilities grant is there. It's to open those new buildings when they come online. I recognize that, and I think that we need that. That was in the formula before. It wasn't funded. I had new buildings open in my district in the last 2 years when there was zero in the facilities grant, even though it was part of the formula. There was no money there for them. So those districts that could have received facility grant 2 years ago or 3 years ago got nothing, and now that their building is open and full, but they can't pass a bond to pass another one because it costs so much per thousand, the homeowners, the residents of the area, will not support bond measures because it doesn't cost 40 cents per thousand or 80 cents per thousand. It costs, and when I gave you those figures, you have to realize that's a $10 million bond. In order to put that on a yearly cost, if it was a 10-year bond, you would divide that number by 10. So, you know, where it was 84 cents in Beaverton, that would be 80 at 8.4 cents per year for assessed valuation, where it was $14 in Moala, that would be $1.40 per year for a $10 million bond. But that's the issue I want to bring forward is the fact that, yes, I understand there's space availability problems, but it's much easier to build buildings in these high-value areas that are getting this extra money in addition to that. That's why I'm opposed to that part of it. That's what I wanted to say, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the time you've given me to have my piece. I'd be happy to answer any questions if I can.
Okay. I did have a couple of questions. Just looking at these school revenue runs, now you did not object to the additional small school weight for, which has also been proposed.
No, I didn't, Mr. Chair. And I did not because of the reason that I said in the small schools that goes to, it's not the same. When you have to cut a program or a teacher in a small school, that's cutting the program. They've only got one math teacher. They've only got one English teacher. They don't have, you know, one per classroom where you do in the larger school. That's why the small school piece is there. What the additional money here is doing is funding the inequity in small schools that say right now high schools have to be 10 miles from the nearest high school in order to be considered a small school. Well, that arbitrary number, I don't know where it came from, but a small high school 9 miles from another high school has the same problem as the one 11 miles. And that's the inequity there.
Well, all these weights, all these factors were designed to address local issues that are extraordinary circumstances. And that's the same thing that we're talking about, $10 million or less than $10 million in the biennium out of a proposed $4.811 billion budget, less than, you know, somewhere around $5 a student. And also, if we look at it on just a pure per-student basis, if we just take the two districts that you cited, Moala River, according to this proposal, with all these, including $47 from Senate Bill 622, will be at $5,377 per student. Colton will be at $5,400 per student. If we go back and look at Washington County, Beaverton, even with the new facility and the $14 per student growth, is still $200 below that, $5,235 per student. So where's the equity in that?
Mr. Chair, I understand your issue with the entire funding formula. I don't say that it's completely fair. I've never said that, and I think you and I have had this discussion that I believe we're probably better off to reduce numbers of weights, not add to them. But I don't think it's right to add extra money to 30 or 40 districts through the formula and leave the other 150 out. That's what this plan is.
That's exactly what we're doing with the added small high school weight. We're taking,
Mr. Chair, I
a very small number of districts and giving them up to $184, $190 more per student.
Mr. Chair.
And there's a whole column of zeros.
Mr. Chair, I said 150 districts left out, not 170, because I included them with that. There are 32 schools that get money through the growth grant, and then there are about 10 or 12 that get money through the small school piece of it. There is a difference, though, with small schools, and that has to be recognized because it is the fact that you don't have multiple teachers in multiple areas. You have one teacher, maybe, in an area.
Well, I know we're just going to agree to disagree on this point.
We came to that conclusion yesterday.
Yeah.
Well, you agree on that?
But
it's just ironic to me that we continually have rural accommodations adjustments and Portland accommodations adjustments, and yet everybody says the suburbs, oh, they're rich, fat, and happy. They don't need anything.
Mr. Chair, you remember I objected to the Portland piece, too.
Well,
I remember.
If we want to reward schools for doing a bad job with their money, I would feel my district would qualify also.
Okay. Let's not
struggle with
them for a while. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Please take a look at the numbers for Lincoln County. I was hearing a lot of the same things that I applied to the last bill. It sure is the same problems exist. When you take a look at the numbers that are here, we lose even more money. I got a question. How much do we have to lose on the coast in Portland before the bleeding stops? Aren't the kids over there worth the same amount? and we can just go right down the list. I think this is an awful proposal. It's add this on top of what you already have in facilities grants and the growth reductions, and you do the numbers I've got here. It looks like about 150,000 per year more walking out of there. Plus, if you take a look at what it cost my taxpayers to build a school down there, if we could build one, which we did once in 22 years, we had passed a major bond issue for some schools, which was right before the facilities grants went in. It cost my taxpayers $3.20 compared to the what it cost in Beaverton of 80 cents. They're already getting a break. So I'm not going to rail on you. I've almost railed on every one of you personally in the last three sessions at one time or another. But my question really is, and I don't think there's a person here that doesn't want to treat every student well, but if you take a look at all the numbers that are floating around the formula for the kids on the coast, and you look at their set of problems, my question is simply, how do you correct it? If you have a way to correct it for the coastals and those small school districts over there that have that particular problem of retirement communities, I'm more than willing to listen. I haven't figured out one, and I'm not opposed to it if somebody has a solution. This one's just going to add one more burden to it. And to culminate since the end of the school year, with what's come down in reduced money, I lost about 40 teachers. One of the best teachers, award-winning teacher the other day, says, I'm just tired of this. He applied in Utah, and they took him immediately, and he's gone. Another teacher who is a very good special education teacher just pulled out. And the disappointment level by what's gone on here in Salem and what it's doing to my schools, I'm losing the good teachers because they can go elsewhere. In my own personal case, I'm not sure that we may not move my wife and family to the valley simply because the situation is that much better. And I've continuously invited people to come to the coast, take a tour of the schools, and see. And I'll keep making that invitation. And then you tell me we're being treated equal. Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Rosenbaum?
I think Representative Thompson may have gone a little over the pale by threatening to actually move to the lower now. That is a pretty serious stuff.
Well, you have to go see what the situation is and what's going on there, and you can see why so many people are leaving. And a lot of this is caused by the inequity in the school system. Thank you.
Okay, Steve, why don't you continue, please?
Here we were at the Pottery Barn section. It starts on page 11 in the amendment. Basically, it allows for $100 million in bonds to be sold and provided to school districts for capital costs. The definition for capital cost is the same that is used for the $150 million that was distributed in 98-99, basically for structures, maintenance, repair, construction, et cetera, as well as vehicles, books, debt service, and reserves. There was a minor change to what the definition of state education projects that the bond money can be used for, to include instructional training. The bonds are distributed on a per-weighted student basis to all of the districts. And as with the current lottery bond program, the youth corrections program is excluded from those funds. The next section deals with the out-of-state disabilities placement fund, beginning on page 13. It continues the current policy started last session to set aside $400,000 per year for school districts that have disabled students that go to or get services provided out of state, and those tend to be very high-cost special education students. So they can apply for a refund of part of their costs that are above four times the normal cost, and that would be $400,000 per year. I only have information on 98, $899 the first year. The full $400,000 was not used, but I don't know what the amount will be for $99,000, 2000. So that some of that money could be used up in the second year of the current money. But it maintains the same level. The next section deals with distribution for K-12. Basically, it says, addresses the question as to what should happen if the state and local dollars don't add up to the full cap amount for the estimate that's being used. And the approach is to do an equal percentage reduction for all districts rather than it just being done through strictly through the formula where all of the equalization districts get less money rather than and the stop-loss and fat grant districts would not be affected by that shortfall. So it maintains that same policy adopted last session. Next is a correction to 1997 legislation. This deals with the legislation that stays down the stop-loss fat grant districts, those that were above $4,800 per rated student, down to $4,800 in 2001. There was an error that affects the 99-2000 year, 1 year, where the fraction for the phase down is in the statute at 1/3. What was overlooked last session is the change in the base from 96-97 to 98-99. And in 98-99, that first third has already been taken into account and reduced in that base amount. And so the next 2/3 should be divided equally at a half in the coming biennium. So we've changed 1/3 to 1/2. That's already incorporated in the numbers that you see in the run. Okay, the next section is the high growth districts beginning on page 17. It requires a growth of at least 175 ADM and over the prior 3 years. It makes a grant of it distributes up to $5 million based on those growth ADM. It doesn't have a number in the bill. It's just whatever that amount for ADM is to distribute the funds available for that year, but the estimate is about $290 per ADM. There's a limit of $500,000 per year per district, so that these funds to the district cannot exceed that amount. It does not apply to newly formed districts or merged districts that would have a jump in students, not necessarily related to student growth, and it has a general fund appropriation of $10 million. The next section is the small high school additional funding. Wherever that starts, page 18, that's a large section, but it's basically saying that for existing small high schools that are not getting a full small high school correction amount because they are in that 10 miles to 20 mile range within the next high school, distance to the next high school. Because of that, they're in that range, they get the full small school correction factor reduced, prorated over that mileage distance. This would calculate what the full weight would be without the mileage adjustment, take 25% of it, and have that as an added weight and distribute $3.5 million per year based on a district's share of that added 25% added weight. And that would be funded again from a general fund appropriation of $7 million for the biennium, $3.5 million a year. The last section is an urban enhancement, what's called an urban enhancement of $2 million per year for a district with having a size of over 50,000 rated students. And I think that, except for the starting date for the various sections, is the concept of the just the concept.
Okay, thank you, Steve.
Thank you, Chair.
Okay, Rasmussen.
Would you mind if you could also review the dash cams at this point in time so that they can also be spoken to by witnesses?
Okay.
My understanding of the dash cams, dealing primarily with some final last-minute changes brought forward by the folks who are working on the, some of the ESD issues, I think in Section 2 are, and the first two paragraphs are perhaps some of the most significant changes, in that they are a stop-loss solution that we are going, we are in this particular ESD problem, we are committed to bringing some of the equity issues between school districts. And we're committed to bringing the 8 lowest ESDs up toward the middle. But rather than freezing the higher-end ADMWs, which will involve, they will lose actual cash money in addition to having to absorb the PERS increase, this particular section in the Dash 10 amendments makes them a stop-loss district for total income, so that they will at least have the same amount of money this biennium as they had last biennium, and not be in a situation where they'd be seeing less money this biennium than last biennium. And that appears to be a very significant issue for these folks as we're putting them through a interim study process, and that trying not to do too much damage along the way. The second major issues show up in Section 4, which are there some language changes, that this is the charge to the interim task force, and there are some language changes here that just been a revised version of what had been previously presented. And then finally, on page 7 in Section 6 is a section that deals with the open network, the Oregon Public Education Network, which has supplies internet connections through school districts all over the state. It does this in a very cost-efficient way, and it needs to be funded, and so that otherwise to try and replace these services on a district-by-district basis would significantly increase the cost, and some districts may not be able to do that. It's sitting here in 2566. People are telling me it's also present in the U.S. West Bill 622, a telecom bill, which may have some uncertainty as to its life expectancy, whether or not it makes it through the entire session, and I would feel much more confident if Section 6, if as the open network piece was addressed in this particular bill, as we move forward. So whether or not, I suspect at this point in time that adoption of the Dash 7s and the Dash 10s may be somewhat in conflict with each other, but certainly there are key sections of the Dash 10s we can move into the Dash 7s and in order to do the best fight ESDs in this particular process. So wanted to bring that forward at this point in time.
Okay. Thank you. I was going to ask about a different subject.
Yeah. Oh, I was going to raise a different subject.
Okay. See, the Dash 9s is another amendment that you didn't talk about.
I do not. Let's see. I don't know that I... Oh, there it is. I do have it. The Dash 9s, I have not read the Dash 9s, but the concept, I think, is to allow districts to receive an advance payment of state school funds for the receive 2001 state school funds in 99-2000, so advance payments for 1 year. That was available to them in 97-99, and this, I understand, is a rewrite, which would allow it again in the coming biennium.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Chairman.
I have advanced the Dash 6s, and I just want to explain those very briefly. They are essentially an alternative to Sections 22 through 28 of the Dash 7s, and in fact, I just checked with Cindy Hunt. Conceptually, it could be amended into the Dash 7s in lieu of sections 22 through 28, and Ozzie may be able to explain, no, will be able to explain these better than I. But essentially, rather than creating a new fund with identified general fund dollars as the dash sevens do, if you look in section 28 and you see appropriations there, the dash sixes address the same result or the same effort to adjust the small school correction just by adjusting the formula, and it makes it a regular part of the formula adjustment rather than a new general fund appropriation. Is that correct, Ozzie? You're shaking his head in the affirmative. It accomplishes the same thing, but it doesn't require a new general fund appropriation, and so that means that it will just be a rolling effect through the formula.
Any other comments? Any other amendments? Any other surprise amendments? Seeing none, I have Ozzie Rose signed up. For the record, Mr. Chairman, I'm Ozzie Rose with the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators, and I have some comments I'd like to share with you about the Dash 7 amendments. When I was here before you some 4 or 5 months ago when we started this discussion, I shared with you that the Superintendent's School Funding Coalition Steering Committee, which is a group of 43 of the 170 superintendents, had laid out a number of issues they wanted to try to accomplish in this session. One, they take the cap off of the facility fund and fully fund it to work on the growth issue, which they recognize as a problem. Two, to make some adjustments to the small school formula to make small school districts viable. We have done a number of things in our move from a local funded to a state funded system, including forcing unification and eliminating 100 school districts. In that debate over the 91 through the 97 sessions, those of you who are here, or at least some of those sessions, we reminded you a number of times that the unification issue was important and necessary to move to an equitable school funding system, but at some point in time, we would still have to address the issue of the very small school districts. Are you going to fund them enough to make them viable, or are we going to force them to close their doors? And the demand for the school reform effort and so forth, what we want to serve all our kids or get to all our kids, if we're going to do that, requires us to pay some attention to that. And the adjustment that they propose is the one that's before you and it's an intermediate step. I don't think this completely solves, none of these ideas solve the entire problem of having an adequately and equitably funded school system. If you look at the 4811 level of funding and look at what school districts say that they need to run the same program next year, most school districts are going to come up short. And so everything we're doing is and have been for the last three sessions as you try to move to the state-funded system, is made kind of band-aid things together through to the next session. And the small school thing, I think that's all it is. Eventually, you're going to have to take a very serious look at how small a unit you're willing to fund and make viable. But I don't think it's fair to continue to fund them if they can't produce the kids there and need the same services, et cetera. The third item, the ESD equity thing. ESD equity is way out of whack, and the material proposed by Rasmussen as a result of that. We also think you should study the ESDs, not ESDs, but regional services. The ESDs provide regional services. Regional services are necessary to efficiently serve all our kids. But we need to take a look at how we provide regional services and ask questions as the current way we're doing that, the most efficient, effective way, and I think you are setting up to do that. And lastly, once we had arrived at a level of funding as high as we could obtain,
address whatever special needs are left with the Portland situation. And to that extent, those people who are troubled by trying to reduce stuff for Portland, the Portland district is a lot larger than the rest of them. It's been an issue since the 60s. There was a disadvantaged child fund started in the 60s for no other reason than once you go through all the forms and so forth, you still have some difficulties with adequately funding the Portland situation. And so that's not a new concept. The only thing that's changed over the 30 years is the amount of the check that's been involved. Those are the things that we came to you with, and related to Measure 7 or the Dash 7 amendments, we support the portion that eliminates the cap on the facilities fund, as Steve mentioned. We would oppose Sections 20 and 21, the high growth addition to the special funding for facilities. Our approach to the facilities funding and taking the cap off it was the effort to try to address the growth thing. It does not totally address the growth problem. The superintendents are aware of that. But the facilities issue is broader than just growth, and it's another issue that you're going to have to get involved in over time. The local option discussion is part of it. There are districts who don't have growth but have buildings that are falling down and need to be replaced. Lebanon has a condemned junior high school surrounded by portables, and they pay for those portables out of the general fund. Lebanon's one of the districts that is in most difficulty at the 4811 level. They have about a 6% budget cut below what it would take to run this program next year, and you're going to have to deal with that. The proposal on the high growth issue, the way it's done, grants passed as a net winner, $46,000 about. Josephine County is a loser of $60,000. Grants passed is the richer of the two districts in that area, or the better off district. And we're not arguing that growth is not a problem. We're arguing that the facilities grant was designed to do that. We made some effort there, and the total effort, as you try to strap together and get every district, so we're no longer talking about an investment in education. We're talking about a budget debate over how much do we have to do so districts don't have to cut or reduce the cut as little as possible. So you're not looking at an answer to the total problem. We're once again in the mode of life as a series of two-year events, and we're struggling through the next 2 years. Off to the small schools directly, would suggest that you adopt the amendments that Sebastian Shetterly proposed, with a couple exceptions, or one exception, on the part of the, where it says limit the districts involved to districts of 8,500 or ADMW or less.
I've written it in. I think it goes
to that. And the issue is there that we don't want to expand to more districts, but Klamath County is right at the edge, and over a period of time, before the 6 years are up, that this is in effect, maybe they would go over. We want to be sure that they stay elsewhere. Maybe they do, but I think that needs to be done. We would suggest that you repeal the section on direct funding and as a separate amount and put that $7 million into the state school fund and just let the formula run. Because we don't want to come back in the next every session and debate whether you add to and fund the small. The small school correction change we're making is ongoing. And there's a section for this next 2 years, the following 2 years, and so forth. And again, I think that whole small school correction and the growth ideas are only stopgaps until we get a level of funding and until we address the facilities issue differently than we're currently doing it. The issues that the representatives raise about which district can raise money, which ones can't, all those things are going to cause us great difficulty. Another point to the facilities issue is that when we adopted the double majority and added the limitation on what you can do with bonding, we have created a situation in which you're going to have to get involved in the facilities of the schools across the state in a bigger way than we currently are. With that, Mr. Chairman, I would answer any questions.
Any questions?
Ozzy, where is the, how big a variation is it now before we get out of what you would define to be equity?
Mr. Chair, we have a statutory definition of equity, and that's the formula. And we still have some flat-funded districts we're phasing down. And when you are done with that and everybody gets a formula run that says they're an equity district for equalization, then you're at our statutory definition of equity. Now, is that equitable would be the next question. When we started this, probably a third of the districts in that neighborhood were not on the equity. They were on flat funded or stop loss, something in that neighborhood, I suspect. And we have over the three sessions, 6 years, reduced that to, there's only a handful that are either stop loss or equity. Statutorily, when you reach that, you're at equity. You'll have a lot of people that tell you you still don't have equity. And the issue of the small, is it equitable? But they still can't run a viable program at the kinds of funding level that have to be addressed. Is it equitable that you are growing kids faster than you can put up buildings? Is that addressed properly and totally? No. Is it equitable that Lebanon can't replace its middle school and put its kids in a regular school and not have to fund it? As you know, because you're familiar with portables are funded out of your operating budget. Lebanon's funding their whole middle school program out of their operating budget. And those are all issues. And our issue that the superintendents that are on the steering committee are a cross-section of the state. There's three of them from Washington County. There's from Josephine County, Medford, Fuller Rich, et cetera. And they have the same debates that you people have here over these issues. How do we do something that's fair to the whole state, and how do we still manage the problems of my particular district?
I recall earlier you testified on this, I think it was this bill, that you didn't think there ought to be any more weights at all. The weights we had in place ought to be retained and that nothing ought to be added. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, I believe I said that in the context that the other part of the superintendent's work, they have a survey out of all districts at the present time due back in the summer to address the total formula. Are the weights working? Are they? Do we need more weights? Do they have the right weights on the factors we have? And that is an interim project that they plan to bring back. And now that you have a committee, I suspect that we'll get more involved in that. But no, should it be changed? Everybody that has a proposal right now, excuse me, I shouldn't say it. Any proposal I've seen brought forth by a school district to fix the formula, fixes the formula so that they get more money. And you got to work on that and work through what does the total group think? How does it work? It wasn't written in stone, if that's what you mean.
But your testimony today is that eliminate student growth, but put in the small, add a small high school.
Mr. Chair, the testimony today, again, the position of superintendent took was don't make any major changes in it. Do three things. Get the cap off the facility fund, make some adjustment to small schools because there are small schools that aren't viable if we don't do something. And three, do something about ESD equity. And as you know, we're moving a fair amount of money around on the ESD side. There are nine, if you look at the numbers, there are nine of the districts, excuse me, 12 of the districts that are flat funded, so that we can move the bottom four or five districts a significant way. Like the Northwest ESD, for example, is going to have a 40% increase in revenue in that equity discussion. And those were the interim things that they thought should and could be done this session. If you were funding at 5.6 or 5.1 or those kinds of levels, then you could take another look at a lot of things and do them better. We view all these things as Band-Aids, and it was the best group of Band-Aids that the superintendents believe would help all school districts. Again, the target trying to get everybody have at least the program they have now. For all of you, as you look at those runs, one thing that isn't showing up anywhere that will show up when your district finally gets the money is that we're not considered in any of the runs the impact of the appeal of districts or that have IEPs over 11%. And I suspect that will occur. The state will go ahead and do that, and that probably will move $3 or $4 million around each year to those districts that have the over the 11% cap rate fees. not a big deal, but it amounts to $6-$7 out of per student for everybody else. That's how that goes.
And you think that this new small high school ought to just be folded into a permanent, the permanent small school's weight hereafter, so we would have variations like 55, 56, 5700 per student compared to Beaverton, for example, 52, 35, Sherwood, 51, 48. That would be okay.
Mr. Chair, small high school of less than 350 kids that asked to provide every youngster with advanced math, advanced science, a second language, and provide teachers that would teach classes of 4 and 5 and 6 kids. It's a lot more expensive on a per student basis. That's a fact, and that contributes to that. And that was my point. If you're going to let them be viable, you have to fund until they're viable. You were hearing part of the debate on the unification. You know how difficult that was. The next step to some of these very small school districts is tell them you don't need a school and you're closing down a high school in a very small town. That's a political and social issue that's very, very difficult and you will struggle with. If you're going to let them stay there, they have to be viable.
Those are decisions that were brought about by the passage of ballot measures that were initiated.
Mr. Chair, I understand that, but you're left with the rock in your pocket.
Other questions?
Mr. Chair.
You know what's left in the
Sir, I have a question. Page 17 of the -7 in the high-growth school district. We have a definition of 175 EDM over time. In my understanding correctly, that you could have a very large district with a very low growth rate that might qualify, whereas you could have a very small district with a very high growth rate that might not qualify, since the growth is stated in terms of EDM rather than in terms of percent.
I believe the answer is correct. And the problem with that whole issue, if you turn the other way, you can have a very high percentage in a very small district and not really need any more growth money, any more money. Because if you've got a school district of 200 kids and they pick up 20, they got 10% more kids, that's 10% more revenue, and they may well be able to handle them. That's one of the problems with these kinds of adjustments. You're correct. The way this one's done, that's it.
That's why a number was put in rather than a percentage, because you get those kinds of numbers, you're not going to be able to absorb them in your average school district.
Mr. Chair, I think at one point you may have planned to tie this to the point at which schools actually need to be built. Why approach it this way, where it's disconnected from the point in time when a school needs to be built? Why not just help schools when they have that challenge?
Is that to me?
Yes. Yes.
I don't want to get into a debate right now on that particular provision. But as I said earlier when I was talking to Representative Byer Thompson, the issue is you have kids suddenly show up. You don't have the ability to then go out, buy a piece of land, put out contracts, pass a bond, build a school, and furnish it and have them then attend that particular year. You have instant, immediate costs, especially where you have growth of 200, 300, 400 kids per year. It requires an exceptional amount of additional cost just to accommodate them, even on a temporary basis, before you're able to go out, go through the whole process of then asking your local voters to build yet another school. So that's what that helps to recognize, and I don't think anybody, even with the statutory proposed cap, would say that $1 million over a biennium is going to help build too many school buildings in any district. Are there other questions for Mr. Rose? Thank you. Anybody else want to speak on this bill?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Gary Conkling. I'm representing the Beaverton and Hillsborough school districts. First off, I'd like to express support and appreciation for the Dash 7 amendments and provide a little bit of a background. I want to say it's an enormously frustrating sitting in this room today, which first off is awfully cold. Second of all, the conversation of hearing us attempt to describe whose problem is worse than somebody else's. And in fact, my superintendents that I represent sent me here to try to work collaboratively to solve as many problems as we could. We have not been one of the school districts, or either of my school districts, have not been among the school districts who have argued privately, publicly, or in any other way against additional support for Portland Public Schools. And I want to reiterate again, we support taking exceptional steps to help Portland Public Schools. We have a very selfish reason in some respects, because the failure of our major urban school district tends to produce even more of the opportunity we already have in rich supply. We want Portland to succeed, and we need it to succeed. And we are eager for you to help them accomplish that through whatever funding means is possible. We ourselves have a problem that has bedeviled us for some time, and I've been to this legislative body on behalf of my school districts since 1993 with a series of ideas that one by one have been acknowledged as addressing a problem that's real, but have been thrown out because they failed someone's test. I brought you an idea this time that came about through the result of community problem solving. My colleague, Mr. Chandler from the Home Builders, people in the city of Beaverton and others who came together in the concept that was included in House Bill 2982, which is a concept that tries to deal with the use of locally generated property tax dollars that could in fact be borrowed, frankly, for a period of time and used for capital improvements in districts that are having a hard time keeping up with buying sites for schools, let alone building them. As I've noted to you before, we've already condemned one piece of land for a school. We're in the process of looking at two more condemnation proceedings. Getting just the land has become a difficult problem. We're at the point of where our schools are so full, our existing school sites, we actually don't have any more room for portables. And we're trying to invent ideas about how to get more utility out of the existing space, coming up with something other than portables. That's our problem. It's an ongoing problem, and it's a costly problem. We have been successful in getting our patrons to support bond measures. The most current result of that is that there will be three new schools that will open up in our district this year, an elementary school, a middle school, and a high school. A high school, by the way, that ultimately, at full build-out, will be the largest high school in the state with 2,800 spaces. these facilities, on the day they open, probably will be full. In fact, portables are already being anticipated at two of the three of them. And incidentally, the out-of-pocket, non-bondable cost that will come from our operating budget is more than $5 million. The facility grant that you have, and we appreciate the support at whatever amount you have, but even at the full 6% permitted under the statute, will cover only 80% of the cost that we attribute to opening those facilities. So we come here today to appreciate and thank you for support and to not take casually the problems of any school districts, whether they're small, whether they're remote, whether they're rural, whether they're urban, or suburban. Moreover, my districts are equity districts. They're two of the largest equity districts in the state. There are members of the group that have fought in court as well as in these hallways for equity. We care about it a great deal, and will continue to fight for full equitable funding of schools. So we don't come here today suggesting that these ideas are an attempt to undo equity, but in fact, in our view, to try to address an equity problem that we might, in fact, have and have on an ongoing basis. So, Mr. Chairman, and I apologize if I'm sterner than I meant to be, but it has been frustrating to hear some of the discussion which is attempting to pit us against ourselves. That's not what we've tried to do in proposing ideas. The idea that you have that comes through this formula, interestingly enough, was a response by other members in this body to hearing the problem and saying, well, if not your idea, what about this idea? And we appreciate that because, in fact, that's been a responsive way of saying if the ideas that we initially came up with aren't adequate, can you come up with an alternative? And we appreciate the negotiations that led to the alternative that are this particular proposal that's included in the Dash 7 amendments. I didn't dream them up. I didn't write them. But I appreciate the spirit in which they were developed as a responsible alternative to our original idea, which was in House Bill 2982. So, for that matter, I may be the only person representing a school district that will come up here and thank you in their entirety for the Dash 7 amendments. But I at least wanted you to know there's one of us. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, John Chandler, Director of Governmental Affairs for the Oregon Building Industry Association. This is my first foray this session into school wars, other than the biennial headbutts Mr. Conkling and I have had over impact fees for schools. And so I brought to the discussion a rather blissful state of ignorance about the intricacies of school finance in the state. I had never looked at the formula prior to this session. If I play my cards right, I'll never have to look at it again. It reminded me of a story problem. I didn't like those in fourth grade. I don't like them now. But I share Mr. Conkling's frustration. And I not only come to this as a representative of the development industry, which has an impact on schools by virtue of the construction going on, and as a parent of students in the Portland district, and as a graduate of a small rural high school with 22 kids in my graduating class. I haven't covered either with my family or myself pretty much the gamut of education in Oregon. I understand the equity issue. I didn't take a quiz on the formula, but I understand equity. I understand the idea that the state, having taken over a bulk of the responsibility for school funding, ought to make sure that the constituent districts are treated fairly. I think that's a delightful idea. What puzzles me, though, and what's been frustrating this session, is why equity seems to apply to the schools I grew up in, and perhaps the schools my kids attend, but not the fast-growing ones. That it seems to me that if you're going to allow adjustments in the formula for various needs of district experience, that the rate of growth in that district should be a need as well. That is it's a documentable fact. I prefer the approach taken 2982. I understand it doesn't have much in the way of legs anymore. But it seems to me, as again, blissfully ignorant, that doing what with the tax money generated locally, that which I suspect the taxpayers believe is being done with it, which is being spent on their local schools, made some sense. Having said that, I think the proposal here in the Dash 7 Amendments also makes sense from the equity standpoint. It isn't just Beaverton and Hillsborough. It's districts around the state that are experiencing fast growth in population of students. That, to me, makes as much sense to factor that into the formula as something that needs to be adjusted for by the state in terms of equity as it does to adjust for the small rural districts. And I know those problems. I live with them. I think it's good the state helps there. I think it's also a big good for the state to help with regard to these faster-growing districts. I hope you will. I think this is a problem that is bedeviling districts around the state, bedeviling school boards around the state, bedeviling parents around the state, and it would be a good thing for the legislature to address. And I commend it to you. I will not speak to the rest of the bill because one thing the home bill is contained on education finance beyond that, but I just stated probably didn't work much. But I do believe the approach taken the fast-growing district is worthy of your consideration. Do I take any questions?
Thank you, Bo. Any questions? Is that it? Yes?
No questions, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
All right, thank you. Anyone else in the audience wants to speak?
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Witt.
If you're ready for a motion, I would move the Dash 7 amendments to House Bill 2566.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Farrelly?
May I ask Representative Witt to recede from that motion, if he would, to allow me to move the Dash 6 amendments into Dash 7 and then move the Dash 7s?
What is the
I think before we start moving a whole lot of amendments, it would be good if we actually talked about where we wanted to end up. So at this point, I think maybe that is a bit premature, Representative.
I'll withdraw the motion if you'd like, Mr. Chairman.
I think at this point that would be helpful. And ultimately, I just had to speed check with Cindy to make sure that we could pass this rough draft of the Dash 7s, if that would still be acceptable as far as legal provisions are concerned. I understand that's okay, and that the final blanks can be filled in either tentatively by the committee today or based on our policy decisions, they'll be filled in. Is that correct? So I think the issues before us are whether we want to do the small school, whether we want to do the Portland adjustment, whether we want to do the ESD hold harmless, whether we want to do the fast growing. So those are the issues I think that we need to get clear on. And why don't we start with the ESD issue, Representative Rasmussen. Has proposed that we do this hold harmless provision on ESDs so that they don't get the same, so that they wouldn't decline based on an ADM, but they would get the same amount that they got last year. Now, that was just for 1 year. Is that correct, Kristen?
Good question.
And I'm not saying forever.
No. And then on 2000 fiscal year, it's for the biennium.
Yeah, it's for the
biennium. Mm-hmm.
Which, some members. There's some ESDs that have declining enrollment that are very concerned that they would have to lay off people and so forth if they actually went on a pure ADM basis being held flat. I'm inclined to support that. I don't particularly like it, but I think it's it addresses an issue that's sort of a surprise to some of these ESDs. Anybody disagree with that on the committee? Thanks. And we're able to do that one. The Dash 9s, I don't think anybody has a problem with. The advanced payments, or some might say borrowing, but we don't want to use that word.
Mr. Chair, I'd look at a clarification on the Dash 9. If the advanced payment occurs and the anticipated additional funds don't materialize, is this borrowing against the anticipated funds from a local option? Or
it's borrowing against future state school fund dollars.
And is the underlying theory that that's because one's anticipating the local option would kick in the second year to replace those, or?
That's one possibility. Another possibility is the sooner they get that money, they earn interest on it. They don't spend it.
Arbitrage.
Okay. Any other questions? Anybody have a problem with that one? Yes. Isn't it generally your small high school? Now, tell me again just what's the difference other than to make it a regular ongoing part of the formula.
Well, that's it. It takes it out of creating another fund, general fund appropriation outside of the formula, and it just accomplishes the same thing within the formula. So that's what it does. I think the idea being that they're trying to remain true to the formula and not create too many pots of money that exist outside of the formula. It's just a different mechanical way of getting to the same point to within the formula.
Mr. Chairman.
Okay, what?
I'm at this point, I'm inclined to oppose the Dash 6 amendments. I mean, we're the way we're working on this is we're looking at various needs. Some of them involve Portland, some of them involve fast-growing districts, some of them involve some of these smaller rural districts. Take one of these needs now and put it into the formula, and this is make it permanent through the formula and not doing it for the others seems to me inequitable.
Mr. Chair?
This has been an effort here where we've been balancing some different considerations and putting it into the formula is going to make it a lot harder to balance those considerations 2 years from now. So I can't support taking one of these elements and putting it in the formula and not doing it for the others. We're trying to make a best policy calculation here in terms of trying to address various needs around the state in districts that are in different situations.
Sure.
Thank you. Representative Shiverman.
Well, I guess the point is small schools is in the formula. This is just an adjustment to the small schools formula. It doesn't create a new fund, and so it makes more sense to do it by adjusting the formula that is already in place for small schools than setting out a separate pot that would exist outside of the formula.
I don't disagree with what you just said, although as one of the other witnesses here talked about, there is a group that I'm chairing in the interim that's looking at this. This is something that the school administrators are looking at, the whole issue of various weights. And before we actually decide to lock this in, this adjustment to the small schools formula, I'd feel more comfortable doing it on a temporary basis and reconsidering that whole equity approach distribution formula that's there in the next session. So I'm inclined to not support the districts also.
I think much more time. I would rather support the motion for the dash six and support what President Sherman.
Okay, well I just think it is an additional $7 million, and some people have said everything ought to be running through the formula. That's taking money away. We've seen Ozzie's run that says you lose. I haven't seen a run that shows how many districts lose under the additional small school adjustment. I suspect that most of them are ones that are not in rural areas that would be the net lose.
Just on the revenue impact side, if appropriation is $3.5 million a year when it's outlet outside the formula, if you put it inside the formula and include that $3.5 million in, there would still be a small additional shift from other districts to these small school districts from 3.5 to about 4.1 a year, I believe it was.
Yeah.
So it makes a small difference whether it's inside or outside based on that.
Well, given that information, it's even stronger to say keep it outside this time, and if there's a permanent adjustment to be made in the future, then and that would be more appropriate.
If I may, the TSD provision, there would be a shift of some K-12 dollars to ESDs because you're funding both open and having a small additional cost from the hold harmless provision.
Do you know how much that hold harmless part is?
I think it's about $1.5 million, and open is at about $1.25 million a year, so that's another $2.5 million.
Yeah. Anybody have a problem with that?
Mr. Chairman, if I understand Steve right, what we're doing is we're taking in the dash, was it 10?
Yes.
In the dash 10s, in essence, we're shifting about $2.5 million away from school districts and into ESDs.
Right.
But otherwise, would not be that.
A little more than that.
Yeah, I'm inclined not to support that, Mr. Chairman.
Well, I understand your reluctance on that. I think the deal is that the ESDs still are providing student services, and it still is considered a credit in the total amount of an ADMW when you add up the local district money plus the ESD money. I respect your ability, your reason for disagreeing with that, but I think the decision is to either keep some of these ESDs at the ADMW amount, even if they lose substantially into them having a layoff, or hold them harmless and fund them, and that requires a little bit of a shift in front of the rest of K-12. Yes.
Oh, no, not more information.
There's a couple of things. Excuse me, for the record, I'm Ozzie Rose, who's competitive bargaining school administrators. A couple of things in the ESD, Mr. Chair and Mr. Witt. One, the part that he just explained to you, that we are moving the group up, but to try to do the balance of those above, it takes that extra $1.5 million or it is. The other is the open funding. There is 622 money that's going to help with technology, but open is the effort that they've made to get a statewide network and do the operations of it and get you stuff on that districts can use and so forth. And there's no operating money anywhere, and we funded it last time out of the state school fund. And if we don't get that operating money, we're going to, I don't know, they'll absolutely quit, but it will severely roll back what we've accomplished. And the state superintendent has made a commitment to get that kind of stuff inside his budget when we come back to you in the 2001 session starts. And but we will have wasted a huge investment of what we've done so far. And we understand that it cuts local school districts, but we encourage you to do that.
Mr. Chairman, is that William? Can you tell me again exactly what the two shifts we just talked about are? Is it together $3.5 million? Is that what you're telling me?
Thereabouts, yes. Okay. You have the $1.1 million per year for open. I think that's what it was.
Mm-hmm.
And then you probably have another about $1.5 million for the SD Home Harmless provision each year.
Mr. Chair, and were we told earlier that this was a sort of stopgap in case 622 doesn't pass?
Yeah, you need
or does this pull it out of 622 and do it here?
You have to do some sort of conflict resolution. 622 also passes. Is that now? Maybe not. I'm confused.
I don't think this has anything to do with
this.
It has nothing to do with
this. Independent of 622.
So that money, the million that's in 622, is that in terms of this?
Yes.
We need to do this.
As I understand it, the open money, at least, is for operations and would not be duplicated by what's in 622 for equipment and other connection costs or whatever it is.
Okay, let's move along. The fast-growing districts. I know there are people who feel very strongly on both sides of that issue. The discussion on that component being included in the -7. Especially Welsh.
Yes, I've been the one that's not wanting to move that at all. I just don't think it's the point I'm necessary, but I'm not going to go against my chair at this time either. I'm going to have to hold my nose and vote for it. I hate to do that, but I have to make a decision here, and I've come to that point in time to make it. I believe we could do something else, but I understand the issue, and I understand yours, and I'm here to protect the small school provisions that we already have established. I think that's important to do also.
Okay. Thank you. For the discussion.
I'm sorry, I missed what we're discussing.
Good. That's growing.
Representative Welch is reluctantly supporting it.
Mr. Chair, when you describe people feeling strongly on both sides of the issue, that describes me. I will support it today, too.
Okay. Then the Portland component, or the urban enhancement, as it's euphemistically called. Any problems with that?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Rasmussen.
My concern is that at $4 million, it is not even close to being enough of what is going to happen overall between what the current number is going to end up with and what the budget has been passed for Portland. $4 million essentially replaces money that these formula changes we're discussing moves away from Portland. We're not really gaining anything here. We're barely holding where we are in after you get through solving other districts' problems. And so four is merely replacing what we're doing with a couple of other solutions here in these particular amendments. The best analysis that I've seen so far this morning is that we're actually, we've passed a budget of 309, and we're going to have to slash another 7 per year out of that 309 budget, and that will mean teachers, that will mean class sizes in the Portland district, and or is not going, or doesn't get us there.
Thank you.
I'll take it, but I'm not too proud to take it, but I need to tell you that we need to go there farther.
Thank you, and it was very interesting, as I mentioned earlier in the committee, it seems like a long time ago, when I spoke to Jim Scherzinger the other day, a light came on with me that what we're essentially trying to do for Portland is replace $25 million in one-time money that was there in the last biennium. And you can say, well, part of the reason was that the state was not adequately funding education. Nevertheless, that money has vanished. It's off the table. And so what we're being told is that anything we do is a cut budget to Portland, without taking into account that there's a $25 million bonus that was going to Portland, flowing through the budget there, that nobody else got, and that has now disappeared, and we're being told that, that what we're doing is resulting in cuts. So I do think we need to be looking at apples and apples if we're talking state dollars versus what particular situation they happen to be in, because they were able to convince Multnomah County and City of Portland to help out. And I think, as others have said, too, nobody wants to see Portland decline. We're very encouraged by the new administration, by the changes, by the experts that have been brought on board in the administration of the district, and we're hopeful that they're going to be back on track, and this is a way to get them started back, but recognize that, that a lot of where that gap comes from is from one-time locally generated money.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate, and Portland, I appreciate all of the efforts and concern and interest that is brought to the table around this school district that is so keenly connected to one of the strongest economic engines in the state. And I do appreciate now. Yesterday on the floor, for the first time ever, I found myself yelling, and I don't normally like to yell on the floor, but I was pretty upset. However, wherever the money comes from, however it is raised or not raised, my daughter will be going into a school classroom, into a high school where we've already clearly demonstrated that children don't even have enough desks to sit at. If you sit up on the radiators, this would be Lincoln High School. And we're responsible for these kids. We're responsible for providing for them. And as I said, I appreciate that there's four coming out onto the table, but the need is still there. And I hope that we will continue to work on these issues before we come to final time evaluation of this session.
Thank you. Any other comments, Mr. Chairman? Representative Witt?
Steve, can you tell us under the Dash 9s how much money Portland specifically might be able to move forward into the earlier year of the biennium?
No, I can't right now.
Any estimate at all?
Assuming that they would have roughly a 3 or 4% growth in their dollars, it would be 3 or 4% of whatever showing on the run of the $297 million, I think, something in that order.
So up to $9 or $10 million.
Yeah, I would think so. Yes.
And the benefit there would be able to put it into the first year of the biennium, allowing them to pick up additional dollars through the use of the local option, assuming it's made available, that would be applicable to the second year of the biennium.
That would be a possibility, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, Senator Merkley. We're addressing the $4 million. We're talking about the early enhancement grant.
Mm-hmm.
like to know that the city of Portland has three school districts in it, and the Portland Public Schools are only one of those. Certainly the David Douglas School District, which is one of the other two, has none of the property tax base that Portland enjoys, has a higher poverty rate than the city, and really poverty is a lot of what drives the need for Portland, and we've talked about the poverty factor and its fact it doesn't capture yet the challenge that is linked with poverty that is common not just to urban areas but to more rural areas. So I'd like to know if this urban enhancement grant carves out only one of the three school districts, which I am quite uncomfortable with. I don't see any easy way to fix that, so I'm not suggesting any. But if anyone has any bright ideas, I appreciate hearing them. And I'd like to return to the high school, high growth school districts. Here we have a situation where we're putting it into the formula rather than creating a fund. And we have addressed with the remote small school and now the small school a problem, and that problem, the remote small school factor, is in the formula. We're putting this in the formula, but the underlying challenge of poverty that drives Portland's challenges, costs, as well as the higher expense of doing business, neither of those are being addressed in the formula. And the result is that we're taking care of everything else and we're leaving Portland out there as a place to beat on in future years as somehow receiving something special instead of addressing it in the formula. Certainly the challenge of building new schools is significant. I'm concerned that most of the funds would go to some of the richest school districts in the state that, as pointed out by Representative Beyer, are more able to afford because they are well property endowed compared to some of the other school districts. And so I'm concerned about that. I think we need to also recognize that when a school district grows and it has a larger property tax base as a result, all the levies, the weight of each person bears for the previous levies is reduced. So there's a factor of new levies being applied, but there's also a factor of carrying the weight and reducing the weight for the previous levies, for the people who already live there. So I just cannot support putting the high growth. It's called high growth, but it's actually not high growth because it's not in a percent. It's been carefully carved to benefit a couple special school districts at the expense of everyone else, and I'm uncomfortable with it.
Okay, Steve, mechanically then, can we adopt the dash 9s and the dash 10s and...
Mr. Chair, I'm wondering if we should bring the dash 10s into the dash...
Well, that's what I'm asking. I'm asking what the process is for how to move these amendments. Should we adopt them separately or adopt them into the dash 7s? Maybe Cindy can help us out with that.
Mr. Chair, Cindy Hunt, Legislative Council's office. I think you would want to adopt them into the dash 7s and be very clear which one, like the 9, for example, prevail over what's in the 7s.
Okay. Okay, very good. Then the chair would move the dash 9 amendments into the dash 7s and indicating that any conflicts the dash 9s would prevail where there would be conflict. Any discussion? Any objection to that one? Okay. Dash 9 is adopted. Mm-hmm. Chair would move the dash 10 amendments into dash 7, also indicating that wherever there are conflicts with the ESD provisions, that the language in the dash 10s would prevail. Any discussion?
If you do that, let me check with Cindy here. the Section 2 of the Dash 10 would not split the state school fund money up into a pot for K-12 and a pot for ESD, but in the Dash 7.
That's correct. So, talking with Steve, I think Steve and I may need to have a conversation about the other special cap. How this would fit into it.
Okay, so how would we do that? We want to adopt the, essentially the hold harmless provisions of Dash 10, but retain the other, the other provisions of Dash 7.
Yes, because the Dash 10 do not have those other special provisions to get the ESDs, for example, up to the cap if the money doesn't come in or whatever.
Okay. Is that okay with your opinion, Rasmussen?
Yes.
Okay.
What was the question?
Okay, then I'll revise my motion to say we adopt the Dash 10 conceptually into the Dash 7, specifically talking about the hold harmless provision and caps and so forth. But the other separate provisions, in other words, having two separate pots for K-12 and for ESDs that are in the Dash 7s would be retained. Do we understand that?
Yes.
Okay. Good. Any discussion on that one?
Sure. What's the net result of having two separate pots? I mean, are we would still be moving?
We're doing what you want to do. Any objections?
Sure. I'm going to object to that one, too, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Representative Witt and Representative Williams object to Dash 10. They're adopted.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Shetterly?
I'd like to at least see where the votes are, and I would move the Dash 6 amendments into Dash 7 with the same limitation on except on conflicts with the Dash 7s, again, with the understanding that I think they would potentially replace Sections 22 through 28. And with that motion, I would also incorporate in that the conceptual amendment that's noted on line 19 of the Dash 6 amendments, adding in the language in the 1999-2000 school year.
Okay. Representative Shetterly moves adoption of the Dash 6 amendments with the foregoing caveats as well as a hand-engrossed section on line 19. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Merkley?
Question for Representative Shetterly.
Mm-hmm.
On page 3 of your amendment, line 27, there is a formula for the calculation of a small high school grant. And the formula is different than the formula that is in currently in the Dash 7. And can you just explain to us what the change in that language?
No, I can't.
Maybe I can help a little bit. Essentially, under the Dash 6s, the small high school grant is being put into a different place in the school funding formula. So under the Dash 6s, a small high school grant is being added to the district's extended AGMW for the first year, unlike in the 7s, where you're getting more like a dollar amount. I mean, so that's why there's a difference there.
Okay. Does that answer your question, Representative?
The language that changed was fairly difficult to digest, and I'll just accept that summary of it.
Thank you. Representative Witt?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I oppose adopting the Dash 6. Now, what we're doing here is at the last minute, we're making a change in the formula. And I think our approach here has been that we're trying to balance needs with districts given separate considerations, and we're trying to use some target dollars to do that. But the Dash 6s go way beyond that for one specific element of this problem, namely the small rural districts. And to not do that at the same time for the urban enhancement, the larger urban districts and the high-growth districts, means that we're losing some balance with the way we're approaching this. And I think you made a very good point. Your interim committee, which is looking at this issue, which I'm a member of, what we're doing is we're really doing the work that should be done in that interim committee. And I think we should continue to deal with this issue and then explaining the way we're dealing with it on a dollar basis, trying to balance and recognize these needs without going in and making this permanent change in the formula.
Yes, thank you. I just want to say briefly to them, I'm not expecting to persuade Representative Witt, but
Actually, my preference would have been to address the high-growth districts through the formula as well by an adjustment in the facilities grant, but that wasn't as narrowly targeted as the high-growth issue needed to be, apparently. This issue with the small schools does not need the targeting aspect that you need with the high-growth districts, I think, so it is appropriate in this case to run this through the formula and not create a separate pot of money outside.
Okay. Further discussion? Okay, the motion is on the Dash 6 Amendment. Please call the roll.
Representative Torres.
Aye.
Representative Murphy.
No.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Aye.
Representative Federman.
Aye.
Representative Bell.
Aye.
Representative Williams.
No.
Representative Leah.
No.
Aye.
Okay.
No. The, did you count him there?
I put counting after I voted.
It was 5-4 with the yeas prevailing.
Right.
So the Dash 6 amendments are adopted. Okay, the chair would move the Dash 7 amendments as amended by the sixes, nines, and tens, as well as the provision that the blanks will be filled in once the appropriate calculations are made based on our policy actions. Move adoption of the Dash 7s with all those caveats into House Bill 2566 for discussion. Please call the roll.
No.
Representative Murphy?
No.
Representative Rosenbaum?
No.
Representative Federley? Aye. Representative Bell?
Aye.
Representative Leah?
Aye.
Vice Chair Rasmussen?
No.
Chair Brokaw?
Aye.
Next 7 are adopted. And the chair now move House Bill 2566 as massively amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Merkley.
Could you clarify your earlier comment about the blanks that are in the bill?
About the what?
The blank lines that are in the bill.
It's in the Dash 7 amendments. The he probably knows where our sending those, where the, all the blanks are, but in the ESBs, there actually has to be some specific dollars indicated in the bill.
And will it just go to the floor with those still as blanks?
No, it will go to the floor with the floor.
Yes. It will be from there.
Based on the policy decisions that we just made in adopting the amendments that Representative Rasmussen brought forward, for example, that changes how much goes into the ESD amount. For example.
It will change the individual ESD and K-12 caps that will end up in 5018 as well.
I think I was checking this. For those of us that have to try to explain this to other packets, are you going to revise these like summary documents that school evidence proposal one that shows actual dollar amounts?
Yes, I intend to do
that. That reflects all the information.
Yes.
Okay, is there further discussion? Did you get an answer? Okay. Please call the roll.
Representative Story?
No.
Representative Parker?
No.
Representative Rosenbaum?
No.
Representative
Satterley? Somebody better vote yes. Yes.
Representative Rell?
Yes.
Representative Williams?
Yes.
Representative Leah?
Yes.
No.
All right. So 2566, move to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and the chair will be the chair.
Mr. Chair.
Good point.
I'm serving notice of a possible minority report.
Okay, so noted.
Number 2 on 2.
Where was the
Wednesday?
No.
Oh,
no.
The
you made me a freshman.
All right. Thank you all very much. This was a very stressful meeting, but I appreciate your help.
I heard the chair is fine.
And yeah, but I got to go to Ways and Means. It'll be after that.
Cool.
Okay, we're adjourned.